Welcome, everyone. This morning, we have the Interim Task Force on Stable Schools. Happy to see all these smiling faces this morning. I hope to get started, and we'd like to start out with a couple of housekeeping issues, specifically the proposed rules. You want to repeat for the record what you just told me about the rules and how they are constructed?
Madam Chair, the proposed rules, because this task force doesn't have any non-members on it, it's all members, your procedures are the same as they are for a regular interim committee. So, in fact, the language in your proposed rules are exactly the same as we have for the Interim Revenue Committee. The only difference being where it says committee, we've substituted task force. So all the procedures are the same in terms of pre-session filing, in terms of quorum, and so forth.
Madam Chair, may I just ask one question?
Sure.
The question I have is relative to any work groups. Do you anticipate that if we stumble across something that cannot be easily resolved in the committee, that you may appoint a some sort of a work group that might not necessarily have, it wouldn't have a quorum, but that might be able to include non-legislative members?
It is my intention to work as much as we can as a committee of the whole. A work group, I don't want to preclude that we would do it, but this is a task force. It is not a committee, and a task force, I think, in some ways resembles a work group as much as anything. So I'm not going to say no, absolutely. We won't be doing task forces. If something comes up and it looks like a good idea, I will do it, but I'm hoping to get the committee as a whole to be involved in all of sort of the policy questions here.
Madam Chair, if there's no further discussion on the proposed rules, I would make a motion at this time that we accept and adopt the proposed rules as presented to us today by Legislative Revenue Office.
Representative Butler moves the proposed rules be adopted by the task force. Any objection? Then so ordered. We have a quorum before us, so the rules are adopted. The next piece under discussion is the draft work plan. Again, we're short a few members. We do not have to adopt this today exactly unless, you know, the quorum before us seems that this is exactly what they want to do. But I would like a sort of a discussion. For your information, our revenue officer, Mr. Warren, and I have sat down and gone through these things. Is sort of to give the committee an idea of our meeting, when we'll be meeting, what we kind of plan to do during those meetings. We are welcome, you know, input, and each of these meetings sort of coincides with just before e-board. That is deliberately done for the convenience of folks who are coming from a long ways away. And the September meeting is more of a... It's sort of designed around discussion, and actually, at the end of this meeting, I would be asking all of you to give us ideas of who else you want to hear from, what other things you want to delve into. So this is a task force. We intend to be sort of guided by the desires of the group, so I'm open to discussion on this plan. And
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a... timing question. You mentioned that you intended to schedule meetings to coincide with e-board.
Well, isn't
my calendar shows the e-board meeting the next 2 days after today, but then again in April, not May.
Yeah. What was the main meeting we scheduled around?
Madam Chair, these actually are scheduled around the revenue committee.
The forecast.
Okay. The forecast. Excuse me. What we're trying to do is be sensitive to Representative Butler coming from Ontario and double up a little bit, so we just have to come separate.
Madam Chair, when we have a foot of snow, I appreciate that. As we get a little further on in the spring, you can call me over most any time, but it was virtually a two-day, minute-to-minute drive this time, and it's not a very pleasant drive, particularly when the truckers decide that they'll just stop right in front of in all three lanes and chain up. And I have a blanket and a pillow in the car and try and carry a little extra gas with me, but I've spent two nights on freeways back and forth already this year, so I appreciate you trying to be sensitive to that travel need. Thank you.
That helps.
Yeah, there's no magic. If these dates aren't suitable or we've kind of... I'm more concerned, less concerned with the dates than I am with what we do those dates. And welcome, Representative Hoff. Glad you're here. So we're talking about the draft work plan before you. And Representative Morton.
Madam Chair, just one question. If we find that in our meetings following today, before May or before September, that there are other issues, I'm assuming that we can amend the work plan to include those additional issues.
Can we not?
You may do that, Madam Chair, with just a vote of the committee.
Yes, and it's pretty open-ended, too, in terms of the language in it. So we tried to leave it sort of flexible.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
The one thing I hope will be included, and I believe from my conversation with you yesterday will be, is a discussion of the criteria that the committee, the task force, might use to determine whether its proposal meets the objectives. More specifically, if we don't know what we're trying to accomplish and we don't explicitly come to some conclusion about that, it's almost impossible to judge whether any proposal we would make achieves the objectives if they aren't there. And so I want to clarify that that is an interest I think the task force ought to put some energy into, and I hope that we can read within your work plan that that will be part of the discussion.
We will make it, I can assure you, you will make it part of the discussion as indicated right now, and I think it's a valid thing for us to put forward.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Anything further?
Yeah, no, fine.
Chair, I move then that we adopt the format of the process, the objective, the process, and the timetable as presented, with the understanding that we may yet be able to add other items to the agenda as we learn of different proposals from the various folks that might be out there.
Well put. Representative Butler moves adoption of the work plan with plenty of the draft work plan with plenty of flexibility. Any objections? And it is adopted. Thank you very much. Well, welcome everyone. Glad to see you. We're going to start this morning with the proposals that were sort of originally put forward, and we're going to ask Mr. Paul Warner to talk about to get everyone in the loop. You can do it here or there.
I think I can do it here, Madam Chair, and address any questions that the committee has. What you have in your packet is six different simulations. Two of them, the first two, are based on House Bill 2450 as it was approved by the House overall and sent to the Senate. That the House Revenue Committee did the initial work on this in the form of House Bill 3460. So those of you on the Revenue Committee will remember that number, but then it went to the House Budget Committee and basically 2450 became the vehicle. The spreadsheet you have, the first one that I'll talk about is called House Bill 2450 as approved by the House, trend projection. So this is based on the December revenue forecast. So one of the first things you'll notice, if you remember some of the conclusions we came to during the session, is that the picture definitely looks better all around because the revenue is higher, particularly the personal income tax. A reminder again on what that proposal did, it took the 0507
was silent really on the 0507 state school fund. That turned out to be $5.24 billion, and there will be an additional $23 million, if the June forecast stays where the December one is. Remember, there was a trigger in the budget bill for that. The bill dedicates 51% of personal income tax collections to the state school fund. Dedication starts in the 0709 biennium. And the 0709 calculation is not based on the 0507 level, but rather based on a 5.318 state school fund in 0507. The excess revenue, when you take the 51% dedication, you compare that with 9% growth in the state school fund. And if there's an excess amount, if the 51% generates more than you would need for the 9% growth, then one-third of the additional revenue goes to a successful schools fund that's defined in the bill. Essentially, districts would apply for successful school fund grants. That fund is capped at 2% of the state school fund. And then the two-thirds of the excess would go to the Education Stability Fund. So in this simulation, the trend simulation, you can see that actually the 0709 personal income tax growth rate dips from the 0507 growth rate, if you look across that first row there. And the reason for that is the kicker mechanism. That 0709 number has $240 million pulled out of it because there's currently forecasted a kicker, as was presented to you in the December revenue forecast.
Stop just a moment. Let's back up just a little bit. I went through all these in the session. They were complicated then. I can't imagine that everybody is still with you. I'm not. Okay. These are the numbers from the last session's numbers that have been adjusted for changes with regard to the new forecast or not?
Madam Chair, these numbers are all from the December forecast.
They have been adjusted for the December forecast.
So December 2005.
These are updated for the December forecast. So what I've done is taken the framework as laid out in 2450 and applied it to the new forecast numbers.
Okay. And let's go back to where you started, which is you start with a 51% dedication from the 0507, but that's not the number you use. You use a different number to actually start with. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And that number is derived because?
The 5.318 was a current service estimate from the School Revenue Forecast Committee that was produced just prior to the 05 session. That's where the 5318 came from.
So that comes from the School Revenue Forecast Committee's numbers of what will be dedicated or should be dedicated?
That was a number that was an estimated current service level for 05-07. So what the bill does is take that number and you know, regardless of what the ultimate amount that was appropriated in the 0507 budget, and you can see it's 524 with the possibility of another $23 million. But when you make the first calculation in 0709 for 9% growth, it's not based on the 524, it's based on 5318. So you get a little bit more than 9% growth is the net effect.
Is the committee... Is there further questions on this? If you don't get the starting point, then you're never going to get to the next step.
I need to come up to speed, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
The 2005-2007, the series of numbers that we're looking there, the first thing I see is the $10.356 billion, and that's from the December 2005 revenue forecast.
Representative Butler, that is the current forecast for personal income tax revenue in 05-07, and that number is higher than the number you were looking at during the session.
Right.
So it's updated for the December numbers, the latest numbers we have.
So that projected growth is at 15.2%.
That's correct.
Over the prior biennium.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, as I recall, 2450 and 3460, they only dealt with personal income taxes, no corporate, no any other general funds or fungible funds at all.
That's correct. And so the top line there is the personal income tax projection, personal income tax only.
And then the 51% is 51% of $10 billion, $10,356,000,000. But the state school fund, 5240, can you help me with what that number is made up of?
Mr. Butler, the 524 is the number that was appropriated to the state school fund in the 0507 budget.
For the 2005-2007.
Yes.
But that could go up by another $23 million based upon the trigger.
$23 million if the June 06 forecast basically calls for greater than $100 million in the balance. Right now, that looks very probable.
Okay, but I do want to make it clear. Had we passed either 3460 or 2450, it still would have been. It wouldn't have been 5281. It would have been 5240 plus the 23 trigger.
Yes, that's correct. The 2450 left the 0507 appropriation level completely silent.
Right.
It was so. The mechanism doesn't start until 0709, the way the bill was proposed.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to confirm that we're not comparing for the current biennium that had we passed or had the Senate passed 3460 as it came through the House and the governor signed it, that we have shortchanged education for this particular biennium. Okay.
Yes. Representative.
Paul, was this in 2440 or 3460, the starting number, this 5240, remember what the starting point would have been had that passed?
The starting number, the 51%, what that would have generated, I believe it was a little over 5.1. It was somewhat less than 5.24, but notice now that under the current calculation, it's a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the forecast has come up.
Well, just, Madam Chair, seems, I mean, this is a lot like the bucket plan, for those of you who remember that a huge part of these kinds of proposals depend upon where the starting point is.
Yeah.
It's just the critical point, and this has always been a question to me is, I mean, that seems a little bit arbitrary.
Well,
and I remember in that session when we just picked that number and it wasn't really a true number, but we picked it anyway, and that was one of the things that was a little problematical, as we say in government.
And I would concur that it was one of the points that was under huge discussion, which is why I stopped Paul dead when we started, because if you don't know where you're starting, because what he's talking about here are projections if, and it's based on a starting point, which you have to, in order to get a projection, you have to start somewhere, Representative.
Yeah.
And so I wanted everyone to understand where he's starting so you can evaluate these projections based on that, because it is an important point and one this task force needs to talk about. But you can't understand anything if you don't understand where you're exactly starting from, and which is why I like, if we can, to move on to the next point, the 5.318 and the school funding task force, and that starting point, which is where we started the next round. We moved it, instead of taking legislative approved budget, we took this other higher number for these projections in this bill.
Madam Chair, if we could continue on with the 2005-2007 and the other elements that are part of the overall school funding, because I think it bears discussion that there is a local school operating revenue portion and it's added to the $5.24 billion, and then some growth rates that are calculated there. Is the projected growth rate of 10.5%? Paul, on the local school operating revenue, that's increase in property taxes as a result of measures 547 and 50, as well as growth of construction in the state of Oregon. Is that what that is?
Representative Butler, that's correct. About 90% of that, or more than 90% of that number, is property taxes. So that's
okay.
Dominated by trends in property taxes. You see a little bump there in 05-07, however, not because of the property tax so much, but because of the common school fund. there was an increase in earnings distributions, and so the land board increased those distributed earnings and have now gone to a policy that should smooth that out a little bit based on a moving average.
So the 2591 may contain elements, in addition to the 90% real estate tax factor that's included there, may contain elements in that that are one-time factors then.
Well, keep in mind that the Common School Fund is going to be distributing earnings on a regular basis, but those earnings, of course, will fluctuate depending on market conditions. The other element that's in there that right now is the greatest political uncertainty is the Secure Rural Schools Act of federal dollars for timber receipts. Right now, we know that program is due to expire at the end of this federal fiscal year, and we don't know what will go in its place. So I'm speculating that it'll stay at the same level in these out years, but that's purely speculation.
If I could, Paul, that 90% is property taxes. So the Common School Fund and the federal dollars are 10% of this number. 90% is just plain property tax.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Just a couple of questions for a little personal clarification here. How much money does the Secure Rural Schools Fund represent?
Are you going to help me?
33
per year. So
66 per biennium. And then in the 07-09 personal income tax projections, up on the top line, the projected growth is 9.9%. So we're to assume there that there'll be a kicker on the personal income tax side too, as well as the corporate tax side.
Representative Morgan, those numbers are based on the current law projections, and as you recall, with the December forecast, there is an expected kicker, personal and corporate, for 07-09.
Okay.
The personal kicker is, as I recall, only about $20 million over the threshold, so it's close right now, but it is built into that forecast, and that's why you see that dip in the growth rate and then a bounce back in 09-11. It's because that refund knocks down net income tax projections for 07-09.
So without the $20 million being taken out, then the total personal income tax will be about 12.4. Is that a realistic statement?
Yes, that's about where we were in the September forecast prior to projecting the kicker.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
While we're clarifying, do I, Paul, read your footnotes to say that you have, for the out years, you've simply used a trend line? You haven't attempted to forecast cycles?
Representative Mullen, the official state forecast with the state's econometric model runs through 09-11. So in those years out there, I've assumed that 11% is the long-term trend. We could spend a lot of time debating that. That's my own sense that, as you look at the recovery period coming out of the recession, we would anticipate above-trend growth over this biennium and the next. And then if we're going to assume there's going to be some cycles in there, then that trend growth will be somewhat between the recovery growth and what the recession would be. So that's kind of my shot at it, 11%. You'll see some of these other runs that when I do the general fund, I'm assuming a little bit less, 10.2%, because the general fund has some less elastic components like corporate, cigarette, criminal fines and assessment, things that would mean that the general fund would grow a little bit more slowly than the personal income tax over time. We've also, and you'll see that we've built in a business cycle to see how this mechanism responds to a recession and a recovery period, and that will give you a sense of how it might work.
Wait, excuse me, where do I see that?
That's our next one.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping we're going to get to it, but I wanted to be sure everybody in the committee was on those first numbers right before we moved on to the projections and how they're derived. And so I'm just trying to make sure everybody knows where we start before we move on. Yes.
Can I try one more just to get this straightened out in my head, too?
It's complicated.
The 05-07, the baseline here where we're starting, I see the 5.24, which is the straight across appropriation to the state school fund, but is the trigger in here anywhere?
Representative Morgan, the trigger is not in there. The trigger would be determined in June. If the forecast stays where it is now, that number would go up by $23 million. But keep in mind that it doesn't affect my 0709 numbers. That 0709 9% growth is based on 5318. It's not based on what actually is appropriate. And that was stated in the bill.
Okay.
You take 5318, multiply it by 1.09, and you get your 0709 number.
And 5318 was chosen because the School Revenue Forecast Committee had that as the current service number.
That's correct.
I think I'm getting this.
Okay, that's an important point, and that's why I wanted you to see the disconnect between the 0507 numbers and the 0709, because there is a bit of a disconnect. You can't. And that's where that 5.318 gets interjected. And it is a different number than the ones we worked with last session.
Madam Chair, would you indulge me in a request to have the 5.47 number put into 0507 just to see what it looks like in the outlier years? And I'm not saying to do that right now, but at some point.
I can guarantee you that Representative Morgan, that Mr. Warner is well used to these kinds of requests. Yes.
Would that be 5.47, or would that be 5,263,000,000?
What I want is the 5.24 plus the trigger.
Right.
23.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rather than the 5.31.
Well, I think it would be instructive to have both of them so we could make a comparison between the two.
Madam Chair, can I stay on 2005-2007 so that we go all the way through this so we know what the components are? I already have questions about 0709, but I would like to continue on. Then the Education Stability Fund down below, this is the constitutional fund that was set up a number of years ago, which takes lottery. It had $31 million beginning balance. The 18% lottery, we're still trying to refill, so we're using the 18% as the refill, is 173, equals the initial education stability fund balance of 204, but then the 5% cap of general fund, that's unaffected. The 204, Paul, help me with that. I thought that we... maybe the 31 beginning balance already takes out the amount that we had in that reserve. That must be why there is no...
If I could, just a minute. Representative Butler, this is another issue that feeds in here that he's raised that is both connected and separate, and that is the Educational Stability Fund and how it fits into this whole picture. So... just for the committee who hasn't sat through all these numbers, we're launching in a way on another issue, but it feeds into the bigger issue, which is a dedicated system. Okay? So, Paul, answer the question and hope we don't get lost again in another sort of forest of things.
And, Madam Chair, I think you'll see that as we look at the stability fund and a number of these scenarios, that there are some important policy questions that come out of this, and that I think you'll be wrestling with over in the next session. On the calculations, what I've done here is I've taken the beginning balance and I've added in the projected revenue, which is the 18% that Representative Butler spoke to, 18% of lottery earnings. That gives you $204 million. Now, the 522 is the cap. So all I've done here is I've compared it. I've said which one is the greatest or which one is the less. 204 is less than 522. So 204 is what you carry forward. And in those out years, when I'm comparing that initial estimated balance, you see that it's greater than the cap. Then you have this distribution back out to the school capital fund. So under this calculation for 0507, the estimate is the ending balance that you will have available in the stability fund to carry forward in 0709 is $204 million.
That's net of any withdrawals which we are making for the 0507.
First of all, we don't have any withdrawals currently for 05, 07. In 03, 05, you had a significant withdrawal.
At June 29th, there was more than $31 million attributable to this. It was then flushed out because we were in an emergency where we could draw that out for the 03, 05.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. I think I understand the 05, 07.
Representative Butler, are you finished with your questioning?
As to 0507, I am.
Okay, because the question I had then was, under the scenario here for the Stability Fund part of this, there wouldn't be anything to draw out of it until 0911 when the Capital Matching Fund became available. Is that a correct statement?
Representative Moore, you will be able to withdraw revenue, both revenue flowing in and the balance, with a three-fifths vote. So, example, you could conceivably come in to the 07 session, and we would have a projected $204 million. We'd also have a projected $191 million in new revenue in 07-09. With a three-fifths vote, you could capture both of those. Now, there are some limitations. We have the Oregon Growth Account that's not very liquid. That's about 10% of the fund, so there would be some limitations on it. But with a three-fifths vote, you could capture the bulk of those that projected $399 million in the 07-09 biennium.
But absent the three-fifths vote, even if the economy went sour, it wouldn't be sour long enough to be able to get into it without the... Yeah, maybe I'm not remembering the triggers right that go to this.
The triggers, there are actually three triggers in the Constitution. One of them is economic. You have a decline in employment for six months or two quarters or more.
Mm-hmm.
That's really reflective of a recession. Of course, we're clearly not in that situation now as our employment has been growing significantly. The other is if our revenue is more than 2% below the close of session, general fund revenue. And in fact, in this last biennium, even though the economy was recovering, we were more than 2% below the close of session because of Measure 30. And so that trigger actually was in place this last biennium, 0305. Those two triggers can be met, but the language of the Constitution is that those are ors, but the three-fifths is an and. And in fact, the governor can declare an emergency. And if the legislature votes three-fifths, regardless of the reason, then you can draw money out of the fund.
Okay.
So the key number there is the three-fifths.
And then is there any kind of triggers associated with the capital matching fund piece of this, or is that can that be made available as it accumulates?
Representative Morgan, the capital matching account is very ill-defined. You would have to enact some implementing legislation in order to put the parameters on that fund, define capital, how it's to be distributed, how it's to be used. It really grew out of some work that the House had done in the 01 session of setting up kind of a matching capital fund with school districts, but all of that would require legislation.
Okay.
And I appreciate you getting to that, because sooner or later I wanted this task force to get to that issue of sort of the lack of definition therein. Because as you can see, the numbers going forward mean that we are going to have to deal with these numbers, and Representative Butler is well aware of it, and that's why he brings it forward. So appreciate this discussion. Are we ready to go on?
I just
want everybody on the same page.
Please talk and go over the how the Education Stability Fund works now, how it would work with this, and what kind of legislation would be required to change it. Would we have two? And can we have these two rainy day funds working in concert together, or should they, were the policy considerations of trying to meld them into one?
Representative Hess, the House Bill 2450 directed this personal income tax revenue into the Education Stability Fund. So, in effect, it's a statutory revenue source going into a constitutional fund. So, what that means. That means you could change that, and you could change that revenue stream through changing the statute. But once the money went in, it was subject to the same requirements as the fund is now. In other words, you have to have the 3/5 vote, you have to have the constitutional triggers to get it out.
So it's not a constitutional change required to do that?
There's not a constitutional change required for the revenue source, but once the money gets in the fund, then it's in a constitutional fund and it's subject to the constitutional restrictions. The one thing that the bill did was it statutorily created a sub-account within the Education Stability Fund that was directed to K-12. That was the one difference. Now remember that the current Stability Fund is just dedicated to public education. It's a much broader definition. So this money did flow into a K-12 sub-account for use for K-12 only.
Thanks.
And it was just the statutorily directed portion that would flow into that K-12 sub-account.
That's correct.
But even though it was statutorily created and it was a sub-account, it still, once it was dedicated over to that fund at the end of the biennium, the last day of the biennium, from that point forward, it was then constitutionally controlled by the fund.
Well, that's correct. Once it goes into the fund, once it's transferred into the fund, it, for example, you have to have the 3/5 to get it out.
Right.
Further questions? Okay.
Can we do that now from 07, 09 to the first cut, Madam Chair?
I'd like to say just one more thing about 05, 07. And again, it gets back to the 51% dedication. And you'll notice that, again, that the numbers that are coming from the 51% number actually exceed the 524, so that the current budget is about, with the trigger, it's about 50.8%. With the out the trigger, it's about 50.6% of personal income. So that I think is an indication of how the environment has changed since you were making the decisions with this last summer, and that's due to the higher forecast. Then the other kind of a corollary to that, if you look at 07-09, when we did the 51% dedication during the session, we were coming up short in 07-09 of the 5797, which again is that 5318 times 9%. So again, a bigger personal income tax number in there is changing the kind of the results of this simulation. You do have a very small amount above the 9% growth on the 5318. You've got $6 million, the difference between the 51% dedication and the 9% growth rate. So you've got the $6 million excess, and the way the mechanism works is a third of that would go to the successful schools funds. That's only $2 million because you're just $6 million above. And $4 million would go to the Education Stability Fund. Now, on the 07-09 local revenue, I've raised these a little bit. It's really based on some work I've done with the chalkboard project over the last few months, just trying to look at some of the details of the local revenue. We don't have an official 07-09 projection yet. The School Revenue Forecast Committee will be meeting on that. But the 9.3% was my shot at I call an extrapolation, and then I carried that out. That's based on a 4.75% annual growth in imposed property taxes. So that gives you a sense. I've also assumed, as I mentioned earlier, that the Secure Rural Schools Act is extended, and the current level stays the same.
Paul, excuse me, the 9.3 that you projected, that is higher than what we were originally?
We were at 9 even. That's correct. So I raised that to 9.3.
What factors, Paul, would cause you to
Well, a couple of things. One is the 4.75 is the imposed property tax estimated increase, and that's based on the trends we've seen. We look to be running a little bit over this biennium, and the property tax revenue growth, so it was a little bit higher, and then breaking out the components, and that led to that little bit higher number. The 9% was basically a kind of a very broad extrapolation.
Madam Chair, and so the as I look at the local school operating revenue, the increase from 0507 to 0709 from 2.591 billion to 2.832 billion, that includes the 3% annual growth that is constitutionally provided under Measure 50, as well as the additional growth that you would have from construction, new construction in the state, as well as the continuation of the Secure Rural Schools funds. And that was $66 million, is that what we said?
That's correct.
Per biennium. Okay. Anything else, Paul, that affected your decision to stay at the 9.3 then, the 4.75 annual?
Well, those were the main things. The other thing I factored in was the growth and the projected earnings from the Common School Fund. And with the, I just took a three-year average, and what I did was I took a three-year average and then had a trending up based on the revenue forecast assumption for capital gains, which is 6%.
Right. Okay. And the 4.75 annual growth, 2 times 4.75 would be 9.5.
There's some factors that come into play there. The 475 is the imposed value, and we do have a distinction between the imposed property tax and the collection.
Oh, that's right,
factor.
Collection rate. Right. Okay.
And so that slows a little bit. And the other factors, the non-property tax factors, when you sum them all up, are a little bit less than the 475 annually. So that's why you get a little bit less than what you'd get if you just used the imposed property tax number. I do have... And I'm happy to make that available to the committee, my sheet, worksheet that's got all the assumptions, assumed growth rates on it.
Thank you.
Further questions from Zane Morgan? Okay. Keep going, Paul.
So if you look at the numbers that come from this, from the income tax forecast and the local revenue projection, you're at 10.2%. Growth in school operating revenue. So these are dollars that would run through the school formula, but most of them would. This would be the dollars that would go to the districts in that two-year period. And then you have...
And that includes, Madam Chair, that includes three items in the 2007-2009. That's both the personal income tax, that's the local school operating revenue, and it represents the amounts of the additions to the Education Stability Fund. Or I'm sorry, no, the two, it would be the additional two.
Representative Butler, the $2 million shows up in the next line, school revenue,
okay,
including
all
successful
right.
schools fund.
Okay, I beg your pardon.
Not much difference there, but that those are dollars that would be going out to the districts. It's just that those successful schools grants would go out through a different mechanism, and that would be determined by Department of Education.
Okay.
Those, Representative Millen, do you understand what we're talking about? Those who were not on the revenue committee and haven't gone through these numbers, I want to be sure you understand the 2%.
And I want to make sure I'm clear. This is driven just on the dollars collected in income tax. It has no relationship at all to the student population, for example. If there's 550,000 kids in our schools, it's the same dollar amount. If there are 600,000 kids in our schools, it's the same amount.
Go ahead. Representative Nolan, this is a revenue-based calculation.
But, Madam Chair, I think we actually did look at the school population in this process. It wasn't made in a vacuum, and I don't think we saw it going from 550 to 600,000. At any time in the projected forecast,
our enrollment projections are that given the birth rates we've seen over the last 5 years, and projected by the our state demographer, is pretty low. We expect it to grow. I had plugged in a number 1% per biennium. You get a little bit higher number when you look at weighted students because we've had more growth in the ELL category, and that would push that weighted student amount up a little bit. But in terms of the raw student count, it's about 0.5% per year.
Paul, are these numbers that we could easily bring to the committee or send to the committee email?
Yes.
These projections and how they're derived.
To the education stability funding then for the 05-09?
The student numbers.
Right.
Yes,
right.
Exactly. Okay, keep going.
One thing you will find, if you look on the back of your revenue forecast booklet that I'm sure you've read extensively, you would find that there is a projection by age group in the very back. And so that's where they have a 5 to 17. Now, there's some other things that come into play there, but that gives you kind of a raw basis for that projection.
I apologize. I might have missed that when I delved into that document.
You were absorbed in some of the other...
some of the other, you know, more heart-stopping pieces of that document. Okay.
So what you have then, going through the 07-09 with a continuation of the economic recovery as assumed in the December revenue forecast, then you have the stability fund carrying forward $204 million from 05-07, adding $191 million. So that, you know, that revenue stream is getting stronger because of the expansion of lottery earnings due to line games. So, and we've seen those line game revenues coming in at or even a little above projections. So those dollars are flowing in. 18% goes into the stability fund. Now, you just got $4 million from personal income taxes, so I've added that to it, and you have a balance of $399 million, and your cap is $583 million at the end of 07-09. So you'd have roughly $400 million at the end of 07-09. In 09-11, you do have a jump in the personal income tax, but that's really artificial due to the fact that there's no kicker off 09-11, and there is a kicker holding down the 07-09 number. That's why you get that little jump to 14.5. And that does push your 51% dedication up to $6.647 billion. Your 9% growth off of 5797 would put you at $6.318 billion. So you've got your 9% growth covered with your 51% dedication, and you have some excess revenue. And your excess revenue there, your two components are the 220 going to the stability fund, and 108 would go to the successful schools fund. That's still below the 2% cap, so all of that would flow into that fund.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
And so that we're clear, and this was a concern, that the 9% increase, that 9% is a simple interest calculation increase over the immediate past biennium. It's not compounded or ratcheted down by the prior school fund. It is truly, and that'll come in your next presentation as to what the ratcheting effect follows. I kind of look forward to that. But as we, the $6.318 billion is the amount which we had in the immediate prior year of 5797 at 109%.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. The local revenue growth, I've assumed the same, so your operating revenue is growing 9.1%, which is really the combination between the 9% and the 9.3. And but if you put in that $108 million for the successful schools fund, then you're up to 10.3% growth in 09-11. The other interesting thing that's happening here is that the 399 beginning balance, if you add the 210 into the from lottery revenue, you would be at 609. Even without the income tax revenue, you'd be close to the cap. So I think that's kind of a change in environment where we've looked at things. What that means is the 5% cap, let's say if we under projecting lottery revenue now, it's certainly conceivable that you could be at or near the 5% cap by 09-11. So that's sooner than we have been assuming before. Now, when you put in the personal income tax revenue through the stability mechanism here, then you're all the way up to $829 million. So you're well above the 633 cap. That means you have $196 available for the school capital matching fund. And again, that number is not defined how it's going to be used. So that would be, you know, a key policy decision for you. If that fund starts to build up, how you want to allocate it, what would be the mechanism, how it would be distributed to districts and so forth. So I've left that 196 as a sub-account balance, though I suspect you probably allocate that on a biennial basis rather than have it accumulate. In 11-13, I'm out beyond the forecast, so I've got 11% plugged in there. And the two things that are different there that happened that are worth noting, one is, notice you've got this additions to state school fund line now has a number in it. That's $24 million. And that is because you've hit the 2% cap on the successful schools fund. So you allocate one-third of the excess between the 73-78 and the 68-87. One-third of that is 138, or more than 138. It'd be 162. The 2% cap is 138, so the amount above the cap, $24 million, goes back into the state school fund to be allocated by the formula. So it would just, it would run through as operating revenue under the plan.
Any questions on that?
That's from the Education Stabilization Fund or Education Stability Fund, Paul?
No, Representative Butler, that is the amount of that would have gone to the successful schools fund, the one-third of the excess, but that's capped at 2%.
Okay, so we don't have a separate analysis of the fund balances on that. It's just that's just pulled through by mathematical.
Yes.
Calculation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Those dollars presumably would be spent. I mean, would be allocated in the biennial.
Okay.
The Department of Ed could set up the criteria, and they would be allocated to the districts in that biennial's current expenditures. But you do have another $329 million that would flow into the stability fund, the two-thirds of the excess. So your growth rate's about 9.6, and that's with a successful schools fund included. And notice that the other thing to note here about the stability fund is that you can see the lottery revenue declines from 09-11 to 11-13, goes from 210 to 190. The reason for that is that once you hit the cap, the amount of lottery dedicated to the stability fund goes from 18 to 15%. That's in the Constitution. Okay, so once you hit the cap, the percentage drops. So that's why it dropped down on a one-time basis there.
I'd forgotten that.
So so you can see the calculations there. You're well over the cap. So you've got 431 to go into the capital matching fund. And then you would accumulate, if you didn't spend it from the prior biennium, up to $627 million. So the last... 13-15 calculation is pretty much the same. You're over the 2% cap, and you can see where you settle down on the school revenue is in the 9.6% range, going to directly for operating to schools, and plus you'd have this large capital fund for the districts.
Paul, can you help me with the calculation on the separate 2% cap, access of that 2% cap on the successful school funds? What's the backup on the 75? I had the successful school funds accumulation down below, but to the extent that that's assuming. See, I had assumed that it would be expended as we went along.
Yes, that's correct.
When you got the 2% excess, that immediately just goes back into the regular formula. It doesn't go through the successful school funds.
Yes, the 150 there on that 13-15 calculation, that's 2% of the state school fund. That's 2% of the 7507. So that would be spent, and that's added down below with the school revenue, including successful schools, and the $11.430 billion. The 75 is the excess that's above the 2%, and that just runs back through the formula.
Okay.
And all of that is assumed to be current expenditures, none cumulative.
Okay. Can we keep going to the next page and just discuss?
Just flip this one over.
Yeah.
So on the bottom of this page, I have my caveat that these are trend projections and they do not include business cycles. And of course, we live in a world of business cycles, and you can get into real trouble by assuming by looking only at trends. The next page simulates a recession that is just kind of my fabrication, but I think it has some basis in it. It would be a severe recession, not as severe in percentage terms as the 0103, where income tax revenue actually dropped 11%. The reason why I haven't done that is because we don't have the capital gains bubble that we had, and that was a huge factor in causing the swings in our revenue. If we do have that kind of recession, we will have had a prior buildup in income tax revenue, and that's not built into the forecast either. In 09-11, I've got a recession hitting, so that instead of the 14%, 14.5% growth you have in the trend, I'm down to 4%. So that would be a very severe recession. We'd have a big jump in unemployment. It would be a severe recession. What happens in terms of the mechanisms of this plan is that the 51% dedication doesn't give you 9% growth. So it gives you 6035, and 6318 is the 9% growth target. So what that means is you've got to go into the stability fund, and again, you'd have to go in with a three-fifths vote. If you pull out $284 million, you can hit the 6318 growth. So presumably that would be the way the mechanism would work. So under the line for additions to stability funds, you have a negative 284. That's the money you pulled out. I've also assumed that our property tax collections get hit as well. Now, we really saw virtually no impact from the 01 recession on our property tax collections. We think Measure 50 has made them more stable, but we also think that was a pretty unusual situation because interest rates are so low. We'd probably see some drop and certainly a slowdown in the growth rate in a normal recession. So if you combine those two, you have operating revenue growth of 7.7%. So you've used your stability fund to give you the 9% growth in the state school fund, but when you look at overall revenue, because of the lower local property tax revenue, you haven't gotten all the way up to the 9% total. So you haven't fully protected schools, but you protected the state school fund part with a 9% growth. And, of course, you don't have any excess there for the successful school fund, so there's no additional money to add in. The stability fund now, you're carrying forward 399. You got 210 projected, and you're using 284. So, you know, you've got an ending balance still of 325 million. Now, I would suggest that in this situation, you'll be in special session, and that 325 would probably have a lot of other demands on it. You can use it for higher ed and some other education-related expenditures, or you can use it as a backfill for other parts of the budget. So I think the 325 may not be realistic to assume that would stay in under these kind of conditions, because, again, this would be a severe recession. you remember it sounds like bring back bad memories.
Getting me twitches here.
So, and then I've gone back into recovery into 11-13, where I've got 16% growth, and then I've got local revenue popping up to 11%. So then you're back to 10% growth overall for school revenue plus successful schools, and you're starting to rebuild your stability fund. Another thing that you could do with a stability fund, another use of it, is that you could allocate here in 09-11, and you could do as you did in 03-05, or in the 03 session, you could reach ahead and collect some of this 228 that's projected to come in the next biennium.
What do you mean reach ahead?
Well, remember when you, in the 03 session, you did two things. One is used funds out of the stability fund that were currently in the fund. And then you, for schools, and then
When the budget was adopted, you took 90% of the projected revenue and put it in the state school fund.
On the last day of the biennium. Didn't we make that transfer on the last day of the biennium?
That's correct.
Hoping it would be there.
The way that the language of that bill was 90% of projected revenue, 90% of the revenue that came in would be transferred on May 1st of 2005. So, and that turned out to be about 120 million. So that kind of mechanism could be used as well. But also notice that, again, by 13-15, you're back to the cap. So I think the lesson there is that the, with the strong revenue growth we're getting from lottery and then putting additional income tax money in, that you would be getting to the cap fairly quickly.
You have projections for the year 25-25. Song.
I'm trying to remember some of the lyrics.
Okay.
And Chair,
yes.
I think Paul's comment relative to the utilization of any funds that are spun out of this should not be lost on the committee, because when you have folks scrambling looking for resources, while we talk about stable school funding and having stable schools, there's a lot of other folks that would be swarming the Capitol in the event of those kinds of circumstances. And we've seen it, unfortunately. And I wish there was an easier way to constitutionally protect these funds, but truly what happens is these funds would be used for education, but then there's this propensity to backfill from other sources to take away from the general fund. So I wish there was an easy answer to that problem we've got.
Good point, and also good point, Representative Haas, that the farther out you project, the farther into this space you go, where, it's some unpredictable thing that's going to happen. I think, though, that this is a way of looking at this that takes a couple of economic scenarios rather than just in the vacuum of, oh, the projections are all good all the time. There are a few of us in this room who've lived in other economic scenarios and understand that you have to plan for something less than ideal. So that just reworks the numbers based on that. Ready to go on? Yeah, Representative.
Yeah, I actually have managed to keep up at this point, and I want to thank everybody for all their good questions, which have certainly helped. But is it, as long as you reach the dedicated amount that you're the 51%, does it really matter where the money comes from? You can take money out and then backfill it with the stability fund, just as long as you get to that number.
Representative Blair, I know there's been some discussion about this. It's not, we don't, of course, earmark our personal income tax dollars in the sense that the dollars that would come from this would have to equal this amount. So, basically, they could come from that source. And I think the way the way the bill is designed is that the 51% becomes a target that and the 9% is a target, so they're comparative. If the 51% gives you less than the 9%, then you have the stability fund or some other source to reach that target. So I think in general the answer to your question is yes, and it can come from other revenue sources, strictly speaking, but it's designed really to be a target.
Any questions? Okay, let's keep going here.
The next two, all of mine are double-sided, and the next two are two different proposals that are similar.
Which one are you on?
I'm on the -5 amendments, House Bill 3460, proposed by OEA to House Revenue Trend Projection. I only have a twin trend projection for this. And those of you on the Revenue Committee will remember this. We had the amendments prepared. The percentage on that I calculated based at that time at 47.8, and that does give us a different number just as it has on the other one in terms of where we are because the forecast has gone up. But just to remind you of some of the elements of it, it dedicates 47.8% or 8% biennial growth. So it takes one of those two as a minimum or a floor. And then it takes as a ceiling the quality education calculation, and I'll talk about that in a minute, which for the state piece only is $7.1 billion in 2005-07. And that becomes a ceiling. I've assumed pretty arbitrarily, because there hasn't been a lot of work on this, that the QEM will grow 9% a biennium. The costs of providing that level of service will grow 9% a biennium. Again, there's not a lot of science behind that. The dedicated revenue above the QEM would go to a school improvement fund, but in this trend, you'll see I don't have any revenue above that. And then it's capped at 2%. And then there's also a lot of language in there about local option taxes to go up to a per-student QEM. In other words, you could calculate on a per-student basis what that would be per district. So if we look at that 47.8% of general fund, so my top row here is not personal income taxes anymore, it's general fund. And 47.8% of that now with a higher number would give you about 5.571. At the time we initially did this, it gave about 5.4. That was the target, to hit 5.4. But instead, with the higher general fund projections, it's at 5.571. And then you can see the 8% calculation to be above the 8% for 2005-07. And then the funding, so the funding floor becomes the higher of those two numbers. And that's, so that's what I've got on that next row. The quality ed model is $7.1 billion, and that is combined with the local revenue projection. So what I've done is taken the 7.1 and the 2.591 for the QEM for 2005-07 for state and local revenue. I've then grown that total 9% per year. Now, we talked about the local revenues, 9.3, so actually the state growth for the QEM would be a little bit less than 9%. And that's just strictly due to the assumption about local revenue. Because the QEM is saying you want 9% growth on revenue from all sources, operating revenue. So if you've got local growing more than 9%, the state is calculated as a residual. So if you go through and do this calculation on the QEM, you'll find it's a little bit less than 9%. And you can see that the gap between the ceiling and floor will narrow when you get strong general fund growth like 2009-11. Notice the gap narrows. But when you get weak growth, like you do in 2007-09 because of the kicker, you see that the gap increases. So that's kind of how it would work. If you had real strong general fund growth, you could conceivably at some point eliminate that gap, because the QEM is growing 9%, and we would expect general fund over time to grow more. So over time, that gap would narrow. And then, by the year 2025.
Questions on this?
Madam Chair, I'm going back now to 3460 as it passed out of the House and looking at those numbers in comparison to where the total school operating dollars would have been under this scenario. The 2005-07 would be approximately $300 million, not quite $300 million less from 7.831 billion to 8162. And I guess that continues to ratchet up over this projection here, based upon the fact that it started from the QEM funding as a base plus 9%. So it stays ahead of that by as I go out into the future. So go out into the future at looking at the 13-15. At 11.43 billion versus 12.07 billion, it's nearly 600 million, and moves from 200 and something million dollar shortfall to $600 million shortfall from the method that we've calculated there.
But if you notice, Representative Butler, that the growth rate is not radically different. It's really the starting point that is different.
And when you have a starting point with that difference and then continue to compound on it, then the brute number becomes larger, but the percentage may stay the same too.
Questions, further comments?
The next simulation that I've done is based on House Bill 3498, which did not get a hearing in House Revenue, but has some of the features of the Dash 5 amendments, but also some differences. What it does is establish two standards, a quality education standard. So again, we're using the QEM numbers, and these QEM numbers, the totals, match what I had in the previous sheet. The 9691 for the QEM and 0507 is the 7-1 plus the local revenue. So that's where that number comes from. So there's a QEM standard, and then there is a minimum standard, which is set at 80% of the QEM. So that's the difference there. Rather than being a percentage of the general fund, it's 80% of the QEM.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did to kind of give you a comparison is to show what the percentage of the general fund would be, so you can compare it with the other proposal. Notice that the state's dollars are growing under the quality ed standard, but also notice that the state school fund as a percent of the general fund declines. It jumps to 61% compared to 45% now with the current budget. It would jump to 61% in 2007-09 when it would be implemented at the quality ed standard, but then it drops down because for two reasons. There's 9% assumed growth in the quality ed overall, and local revenue is growing more than the 9%. So both of those factors mean the state school fund under the QEM would grow slower than the general fund, and you can see the general fund numbers are generally above 9%. The minimum standard just takes 80% of that, so it would show that same pattern with the general fund falling. But it would jump from 45% in the current biennium to 48.9% in 2007-09. And that gap between the two would stay the same proportionally, although in dollar terms it would increase up to about $2 billion by 13-15, because it's just 80% of whatever that quality ed standard calculation is.
Madam Chair, when the committee discussed these different scenarios in the regular session, was there an aspect to the discussion that considered the impact on the rest of the state budget?
No. Yes and no. Go ahead, Representative Cass. It was in our minds, I think, but
that
we didn't.
To me, is one of the largest problems with this. And I mean, it could be initially seductive for school advocates to say, finally, we've got more money than the money we need, but what does that do to higher education or human services? If you just say, I mean, you're not adding a single dime to any of these plans. They're just channeling a different, sometimes larger portion to K-12. Okay, so that doesn't do any favors to state police. That is one of the central problems that came up over and over again in the work group we had on this, and it's, you know, it's probably why I will always oppose this approach to stabilizing taxes.
Is there any reasonable way to have a discretion? I mean, there are issues that are faced on the budget side of this routinely are the caseloads in DHS, the caseloads in the prison system, the needs of the court system, the needs of higher ed and community colleges, and all the other places that we put Oregonians' tax dollars. And I have the same misgivings that Representative Hass is talking about when I see a plan here that potentially commits 49% or 61% of the personal income taxes to one area of spending without taking a look at what the dynamic is going to be when you get into the other areas that we're also constitutionally obligated to provide.
And Madam Chair, that's the one that we're looking at on 3498, that's percentage of the total general fund, not just the personal income tax. That's everything.
Well, that just underlines the situation even more.
And I don't know that we spent in House revenue on 3498.
Was it even
a percentage? No, we did not have a hearing on it.
I think if I could sort of frame this, that's why we're here. To talk about these kinds of things. In the Revenue Committee, we looked at specific proposals. You're seeing some of the projections we were looking at. Do we want to pursue this? What other ways could we pursue this? And what its implications are, I think, are important questions. And I think that's why this task force is moving beyond just the work that was done in the legislature to some of those bigger questions. So when I answered no, the answer is yes, we considered it, but not in terms of the whole budget picture. We were looking at what it would do if we did this, the what ifs that are in these kinds of numbers. And one of the questions is, how can we approach school funding in some way that gives some assurance to schools and at the same time takes into consideration some of these other budget issues that are bigger than just schools? So I think you kind of hit on some core pieces here.
And we just, I mean, schools are probably the most popular advocacy in the building, but we could just as easily be up at this panel discussing, you know, how to fix state police.
Get a room full of state police and then ask them who's the most popular.
Yeah. They could say, well, what we really need is 10% of the general fund budget or 10% or 12% of personal income taxes, and that would just solve our problems forever, will go away. And the very identical kinds of things could, these charts and extrapolations, and we could be looking at the year 2525, and we could put an arbitrary percentage there for state police, and we could put percentages for all of these things. And then that raises a question, why even have a legislature? Because we've got it all parceled out, and nobody needs to make any decisions, and we'll just have a big distribution formula and let this all go to where it should go based on revenues, not on the real world.
Oh, except in the meantime, there's bound to be some initiatives that mix it all up.
Now we're getting into a sort of a wine session about being legislators, and I'd like to sort of redirect that, if you don't mind. Are there any specific questions?
I was going to ask Representative, put that in the form of a motion. I'm not exactly what you asked.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Could I make a request?
Sure.
The staff to run out the same calculation. You've done a calculation of under House Bill 3498 what percent of the general fund would go into the state school fund. I don't see that in any of the other analyses, and I think it would be helpful for comparison. For example, under House Bill 2450, what percent over time of our general fund would be dedicated to the school fund under that bill?
Any other requests? Any other? Have you got anything more, Paul?
I have one more.
More scenarios.
I can more scenarios.
Okay. We need to go.
I think I can go quickly on this,
okay.
Madam Chair. It's this is a look at the governor's school funding proposal, and we do have James Sager on the agenda to talk about that. Just to give you some differences in what the governor has proposed and is looking at as he develops the recommended budget. Couple of differences here in terms of the versus 2450 in particular is 61% of the general fund is dedicated to education. Not just to K-12, but to education in general. And I made some assumptions about what that would mean, and that there may be some differences in how that actually comes out in the budget. The state school fund in 05-07, and the all other education spending I've taken out of the 05-07 budget at 1.598. So that includes higher ed, Department of Ed. So you're about $1.6 billion for that other component of the 61%.
The governor has set a target of operating revenue growth set at 10% per biennium, and two-thirds of the excess general fund revenue goes into the stability fund, one-third to the successful schools. But you'll see there is a different mechanism for how that works once you hit the cap. If you look at the 07-09 numbers, I've also calculated the K-12 number for 07-09 on the state school fund at 10%, but I've calculated that based on the 5318. So that was my understanding of the proposal, just as it is under 2450. So again, we're not using the actual, we're using the 5318. You do have some excess revenue when you do that calculation. You can see that up above there, I've got at 61%, I've got about $7.7 billion to allocate to education. That's 61% of the general fund revenue. Okay, not personal income tax, but general fund. So I've got 7.7 to allocate, and I allocate 10% to K-12 for their growth on operating revenue, and 10% on all other education, which is the 1.6, goes up to 1.758. And then I have some excess revenue there when I calculate the 61%. I've got 112 in excess revenue. The successful schools fund would capture 37 of that, or one-third of it. Now, that's not K-12 only. That would be allocated by the joint boards, would determine how that's allocated, and James can talk about that. What I've assumed here is I just took the current proportions in the budget. K-12 is about 77%, so I assume they got 77% of the successful schools allocation, and that would be 29 of the 37 million. There'd be 75 more that would go into the stability fund, which is the revenue above the 61%, or above the 10%. The 61% is above the 10%. And then you can see, again, the calculation for the education stability fund. When you add in the $75 million, we're up to 470 as an ending balance, still a little bit below the cap. Where you see the change in the governor's proposal and the mechanism, the significant change is when you hit the cap. And that happens in 09-11. You have excess revenue of $430 million after you've covered your 10% growth. And when you allocate two-thirds of that to the stability fund, which is the $286 million, you end up well over the cap. The cap is 5%, you end up with 966. So under the governor's proposal, the general fund dollars above the cap would go back to the successful schools fund. So you get a big jump in the successful schools fund up to $330 million because you're not using that excess revenue to go into the capital matching fund. That's the big difference in those two mechanisms. You do have money going into the school capital account, $47 million, but that is the lottery money. That's the lottery money that's above the cap, not the general fund excess dollars. So you still get the cap, you still get above the cap, but that money is flowing back into the successful schools fund. And again, the part going to K-12, I've just taken 77% and assumed that would be allocated by the joint boards. When you look at the growth rates, for K-12 and percent change in revenue, you can see it jumps to 13% in 09-11 because you've got a lot of excess revenue there for the successful schools fund, but then it's down to the 10% range as you look ahead, including local revenue.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
In any of these bill proposals here, is the successful schools fund, the use of that defined very well? What is that all about?
That was something, Representative Morgan, that we had a lot of discussion in with the original bill in the work group. And we put some parameters on it. They're all up for some sort of grabs. I don't think it's set in stone. You can envision this mechanism any number of ways, and if we get that far, I think we can discuss how that might work. Representative Hass can remind me. We had a lot of discussion
about what that might look like, the original proposal had.
I think we ended up with football team records.
Well, and it seems to me, too, part of the discussion would need to revolve around how explosive the balances were, because there would be issues around ramping up a new program to absorb that revenue in any kind of a reasonable way.
And we had that kind of a discussion, too.
We talked about granting the schools that had special needs and special issues.
We were trying to not make it that. We were trying there was plenty of discussion about that. Oh, we have this one-time windfall, and that's part of the reason it was capped, and over the cap it went right back into the formula because we were trying to avoid that. And in the end, I think our final vision was something that would be helpful to those schools who aren't making it, the struggling schools, in some way, with a recognition that through ODE there would be a mechanism, is my memory correct on that, that would basically address the schools that under No Child and whatnot are clearly struggling, and use it not to solve their problems with just an infusion of money, but solve their problems with an infusion of a work plan, and give them basically help to not be struggling schools, rather than just go in and support a football team or some program that basically, because there was plenty of discussion, it's an important one, and in any of these proposals, there is a need to define what that needs. But the ultimate idea was that if it gets to be a very large number, and in these projections it can, that it would go back into the formula directly to be distributed to all schools. And there was that was sort of a mechanism piece that said, you know, we're not going to build up some one-time dedicated thing. It's a small piece that then would go right back.
Well, and if the thought is to help underachieving schools raise their achievement levels, wonderful objective, but functionally how you get there, I mean, you don't have a bunch of freeze-dried experts in the closet that you're going to bring out and have ready to do this.
Actually, we found plenty of freeze-dried experts who said they knew how to do that, okay, if they just had a little money. I don't think we had any trouble finding experts who said that if they had a little pot of money to do it. Representative Hass, would you disagree with that?
No, we've never had problems finding experts around this place.
Freeze-dried experts are...
Put them back on ice.
It is confusing in the successful schools. Perhaps it should be called something else, but it definitely not going to reward the Riverdales and the Lake Oswego high-achieving schools and help them be even better. It was actually kind of the opposite of that, but we didn't change it to struggling schools or anything.
We didn't figure anybody wanted that label. There was plenty of discussion about it.
Miss of winning Vail in the final championships this year in high school ball, I think Representative Hass's suggestion to remove it to the schools with the best ball teams is probably a good idea.
And I'm glad we got that on the public record.
You bet.
Good question, and something that needs to be on the table as we proceed. Anything further? Let's go, Paul.
Okay, my last scenario is taking the governor's proposal and simulating a recession on it. Pretty much the same concept as we looked at in 2450. One thing to notice is that this, because it brings out a conceptual point, that the general fund assumption here is to grow 5%. Remember, the personal income tax, we had 4%. And then we had a comeback of 16% in the personal income, 14% here in the general fund. That reflects the fact the elasticity of the general fund is less than of the personal income tax. That means it won't grow as fast over time, but will be less volatile in the short term. In 2009-11, we can't hit our 10% target when we allocate the K-12 share of education. Is 6233, and that doesn't get us to our 10%. So we need to allocate $201 million from the Stability Fund and $263 total from the Stability Fund, with the other $62 going to the other component of education. So we want to keep both of them at 10%. So we take $263 million from the Stability Fund, and we're able to hit those targets with that. And again, as we saw with 2450, we still have a fair amount left over on the Stability Fund, but
as you talked about earlier, there would probably be pretty intense discussion of those balances and what to do with them if we were in a recession of this magnitude. Again, 5%, you know, general fund growth for biennium, that's about, you know, a little over 2% a year. So it would be pretty limited growth, and it would probably be well below the forecast.
Questions?
Madam Chair, again, Dr. Warner has brought out the fact that when that time comes, and it will come, that we will have everybody back at the table trying to get their share of what they feel is appropriate for the appropriations process. So I guess the elephant in the room is, while we talk about 51% or 61% of personal income tax, general funds, any percentage of these funds, I think Representative Hass has alluded to it, that are the projected funds going to be adequate for the size of the growth of government? And maybe in this discussion at some point during this interim, we'll have a discussion of the funding, the total state's ability to raise funds in good times and bad.
Thank you. Further questions? Comments? If you note by our agenda, we are at the 10 o'clock hour, and I have asked...
That's usually my coffee break time.
Yes, and we did not put a coffee break in or a quick break. I would rather keep going.
I'm just curious if there are other states that have these kinds of plans in place, and I'm sure that the committee examined those in the session.
I wouldn't say that we exactly did. Polly, want to speak to that?
I'm sure there are states that have gone to percentages. California, for example, has a requirement on education, a percentage of their budget. Probably the one we talked about the most in a different context was the Colorado system, because that not only does Colorado, we normally think of the spending limit, mm-hmm. but there's also a growth target for education. And one of the problems they've had, those two have often been in conflict. And that's why one of the reasons why they went back to their voters to have some modification of their spending on it. But there are states that do have those kinds of requirements.
And have they been in place for a period of time where you could judge how they're working?
Representative Morgan, I could put something, you know, kind of a summary for you to gather and see. I wouldn't say offhand there's any definitive answer that I know of. I mean, it does. The trade-off you have is you create some certainty in terms of what the dollars will be, but you limit flexibility. I mean, those are the trade-offs that you have. And I could put together a summary of what we know and what kinds of rules and mechanisms are out there for the task force.
Would the chair indulge me in asking for that to be generated?
And Madam Chair, if the November vote was any indication in Colorado how successful that program had worked, the voters certainly spoke their mind relative to Tabor.
There was discussion in the task force and the work group in putting this together that we were careful not to get that ratchet part that was the problem that became very clear in the Tabor. This ratchet effect that you have, and we tried to avoid that, and Paul alluded to it in these mm-hmm. numbers, so that the projections would go forward, not be ratcheted down with any turn down.
Which is where Colorado got into.
Yes.
Play.
Well, but the Colorado problem is the ratcheting, but also there's an inconsistency between the spending limit and some of these other requirements they have, like the education spending. They have a growth requirement on education spending, so they were required to increase education spending at the same time they were required to reduce overall spending. So they had that conflict when they had these conflicting targets within their constitution and statute.
Well, are there also not some of those kind of conflicts in the California model also? They have some class size limitations that cause some problems.
Yes, mm-hmm. And they have a required percentage of their budget that goes to education that restricts some of their flexibility.
And Florida, I think, has class size limitations on marriage as well.
Okay. Any further things that we want to ask of Paul to put on his work plan?
My homework.
Your homework?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'd rather not take a break, if you don't mind. Let's keep working, and those that need a short break can take it. And I'd like to invite Duncan Wise from the Oregon Business Council to come up and get his perspectives. I don't know how many of you were at the recent OBA summit. I was, and I'd also like him to speak to these proposals sort of directly. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council. I want to thank you for inviting me this morning to talk about this really important issue of education funding stability and the Stability Fund. I will try to talk about the specific proposals in general, but that actually isn't my main purpose this morning. What you embarked on this interim, I think, is perhaps the most important work imaginable, which is really, I think, we're in the process right now in this period of time in really defining what the role of the legislature and state government in general is in relation to education. And I say that with the historic perspective that in around 1990, the world changed on us, and we've been grappling with this ever since, what the role of state government is in relation to schools. And we've learned a lot over that period. And based on that learning, I think it's time to really step back and ask the most fundamental questions. What is the role of state government in relation to the schools, the school districts, including K-12, community college, and higher ed? And how do we define a role at the state level that helps schools serve the students in the best way possible? And there are three key goals I think you need to think about as you do that work. One is the question in front of us, stability. We know there's a huge issue of the stability of funding for these services, and that you've experienced very painfully how difficult it is to provide stable funding with the revenue system that's in place in Oregon. But there are other goals as well that you need to keep in mind. Second is adequacy. How do we ensure that not only is it stable, but that it's adequate to meet the goals? And third, it's performance. How do we create a state-level governance system that encourages perpetual innovation and perpetual improvement in performance in the delivery of education? I think we need to keep all three of those goals in mind as we do this work. As you think about those goals, I think ultimately you're going to discover that you have to pretty fundamentally change the way that the legislature relates to the education community. It's going to be a change in governance, a change in the way we do budget, a change in the way we distribute the money. And that really should be the task at hand. So as you think about this issue of stability, please also keep in mind the adequacy and the incentives for perpetual performance. That's really the message I would like you to consider. And with that in mind, then I'd like to walk through, again, a little bit of history, a little bit of our perspective on how the system's performing today, and then what I think the agenda needs to be going forward. Briefly on the history, and you know this, but I just think it's worth setting the context. In 1990, the world changed fundamentally around the relationship between the state government and schools with the passage of Measure 5, and at the same time with the passage of the Education Act for the 21st century. Measure 5 put in your hands the responsibility for setting the funding level and distributing to schools the money, and your decisions that you made in those early years to distribute the money on an equalized basis basically took the entire funding system into your hands, because with the equalization you effectively took property tax, and so with that you took all the funding for education, said the state legislature is now responsible for setting the funding level and sending the money to the districts, and the districts basically what was a locally based system of funding became a state system of funding. A huge shift and responsibility that it was historic and again thrust the state into a set of responsibilities that it had never assumed before. The same thing has happened in the community college system. The state board is now committed to equalizing state funding for the community college, and so essentially you now have higher ed, community college, and K-12 all funded by the state, with the state making a decision on funding levels and distribution. And again, a fundamental change in the way we run the education systems in Oregon. With that in mind, the legislature did try to create some tools to help it do its job in establishing the funding levels. One of the most important was the database project, which we tend not to remember, but that became the tool that gave you the ability to understand how money is being spent in the K-12 system. You can go out and look at how districts spend their money in a consistent way. At the time, a revolutionary idea, and one, again, I think a tool still available. It's really, really important for you to understand that you can use that to understand how schools spend their money, how additional dollars might affect the ability of schools to increase programs, and a tool that I think is really, really powerful. The database project not only gives you financial data, it ties financial data to the second major reform you adopted in the early 90s, performance data. You can measure how schools are not only spending, but what their performance is in terms of reading scores, math scores, the various tests the state administers. So you have a way of looking at both funding and performance at the same time, which creates a very important set of tools for, I think, managing the education system in Oregon. So major change in the early 90s, both in terms of funding responsibility and at the same time with the Education Act, setting performance expectations for schools, thrust the state in a very different role around the management and governing education. Now, at this point, I think what is important as we reflect on 15 years is to really think deeply about what your role is in education. I want to give three different perspectives on what your role could be. And I think as you do all your work, I think it's really important to think about this. Role one, you could assume, is to say our job is basically a grant-making responsibility. We're going to send money to the schools at a certain amount, and we're going to assume that the schools are performing as best they can with the local governing boards taking responsibility. And we're basically not going to pay much attention other than just to distribute the money. It essentially puts the state in what you might call an autopilot mode. We're going to figure out how much money they get. We're going to send it down and assume that they're going to do the best they can with it, and we'll give as much as we have available by some formula to distribute to the schools. That's one plausible role in the to say that basically we're going to take a hands-off role and just see our role as a distribution function. The second opposite role, which I think you could arguably assume, is to say, we're in charge now. We're going to run this thing. We're going to start giving more and more prescriptive roles on what salary should be, what practices should be. We've got the money. We've got the power and the tools. We're going to increasingly take responsibility for how this enterprise is run and take a management responsibility. It would be a very plausible role you can take. I have seen both of those behaviors as one who watched the legislature, both those perspectives emerge over the last 15 years, more prescriptive as well as the theory we ought to just take our hands off this. The third role, which is one would like you to think about, and one I think is really perhaps the most plausible long-term role, is to think of yourself not as the manager of the schools and not simply as a general grant maker, but as the procurement agent. On behalf of students, your job is to figure out who the students are and how much money per student that you want to spend for those services, and define the services very, very precisely. What elementary education, middle school education, high school education, how many students are there, how much are we going to spend per student, and what are our performance expectations for the dollars that we allocate? And to think of your role, again, not as the manager, but as an agent on behalf of the students that are sending dollars out to the institutions, but with specific performance expectations. I think that's a role that you could play and that the state could play that could both help you make better decisions, but more importantly, improve the quality and performance of these institutions on behalf of students. This choice that you make, depending on which way you go, will affect how you organize the Ways and Means Committee, the Revenue Committee, how you do the distribution formulas. The choice you make on your fundamental role is absolutely critical in terms of what you do in terms of the decision specifically ahead of in front of you on the stability fund, but also in terms of how you manage your oversight of the education delivery system. And as you go through your work this year, I really would encourage you to think deeply about that issue. We have a paper which we presented, what costs, what results for pre-K-20, which really is takes a look at the current practices of budgeting and distribution in the education enterprise, and in light of performance expectations that we imagine we would want to achieve in terms of the education services in Oregon. And what we conclude is that the current system of budgeting that has a separate K-12 community college and higher ed budget system, without much transparent data about how the money is spent in those systems, is not adequate to achieve Oregon's, if we have ambitious education goals for Oregon. It's not an adequate but finance and budgeting system to support the kind of delivery we want. In two major respects, it comes out short. One, it does not unbundle the data sufficiently to make to really understand the drivers of costs in the system, especially in K-12. K-12, that $5.4 billion, is buried in there are a whole lot of different program areas that we need to understand more precisely. Special ed, transportation, elementary education, all those elements need to be unbundled, and so that you can see the whole education enterprise in terms of much more transparent data. The second way it comes up short, in our view, is that by balkanizing it, by having separate funds, it's hard to make trade-offs among the different education services. And as we see the blurring of lines, as we do in terms of K-12, community college, and higher ed, having separate silos is really going to impede the ability to design services that really work best for students. Just one quick example of that is in the high school arena. The largest high school in Oregon, I don't know if you know this, but is Portland Community College. And again, there's a lot more delivery going on. Again, if you look at the high school years, students are moving in and out of higher ed, community college, and K-12. And again, you've got a system that balkanizes those services, and I think there's a strong argument you need to think about them as one system on behalf of students with performance expectations built in throughout. So, with that in mind,
Duncan, how do we account for? Don't we account for some of that movement of students between the high school population in the greater Portland area and the community college, so as to reimburse the community college for those high school students? How do we account for that statewide? Is that, I mean, I've got a community college in Eastern Oregon and Southeastern Oregon, Ontario, and I know they do that, but there's some of that that's already traded off. Sure. So when we bundle those together, then effectively the school board is unbundling a portion of it for the community colleges.
Right. And Madam Chair, Representative Butler, there are a lot of different mechanisms that are used, and they're all within the school systems between in the local community level. My only point is, if you're thinking from a state perspective and dollars per student, the goal is providing services to students. And the question you need to ask, and again, without answering it, is do you care where the service is provided if you're providing services to a high school student? That's the kind of trade-off that needs to be considered. And again, right now, because you've got these balkanized systems, it's not an obvious or easy thing to do.
Madam Chair, I guess the point that I'm trying to drive to is that while we have basically moved education to the state, being a state responsibility, and have provided those resources and back to the local communities. Really, it's a local community decision as to how that school will participate with the community college and get the maximum education for that child. So I guess in that regard, while it's kind of top-down driven from this way, that's one of the ways that we've left it open for it to be kind of bottom-up driven by those local school, and until I get the community colleges down here saying, boy, this is wrong, the way that Portland community schools want their education delivered by us, then I guess it's the squeaky wheel theory, and it's being driven, as I see it, it's been driven locally.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And again, the question is, as you look at these dollars per student, I mean, you've got community college, you get one capitation rate, high schools get another, and again, these just simply aren't integrated. At the state level, it's not a conversation that's integrated into one in terms of how much we should be present and how much should go per student, high school student, if they choose to go to the community college. You could have a state level conversation. Senate Bill 300 obviously was the beginning of that, but this as you see students traveling through the system, I would argue that the issue isn't whether they're in a community college or higher ed, it's what is the service, and the dollar per student should be arguably consistent regardless of where they're receiving that service. And that's the point. And right now you have the dollars per student at higher ed may be different from the community college, would be different from the high school, and again for potentially the same service. And again, a conversation here about a budget system that was focused on students and the services you're providing, I think would be a more powerful way of understanding the state role and investing in these students.
Duncan, excuse me, but I didn't make it to the education presentation. I got tied up in some hallway conferences while this was going on. Is the discussion around the equality of opportunity or the equality of funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, that is a very critical question. And I think what you want in the budget process is a budget system that allows you to have that debate. Without answering it, if I'm understanding your question, if you're talking about equity, a budget system that has a dollar per student, as we do now for general education, and then additional weights or dollars for special needs students of different kinds, special education, second language, I would argue you need a budget system that explicitly reviews that on a regular basis and allows you as policymakers to make your decisions based on your own values and on data, on what it costs to help special needs students, again, whatever their category, to achieve those results, and that it would allow regular feedback in
the system. But then getting back to Representative Butler's point, at best that's a discussion around an ideal, because we use it as a distribution formula, but the districts don't use it as a spending formula.
That, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, and that becomes the budget framework that I would recommend you think about is one where you distribute dollars on the basis of the weights with performance expectations in mind. The second part of the process would be to review the performance, the spending and performance of school districts to see if they're meeting the targets you establish. So, for example, if you have an English as a second language allocation, you ought to establish some goals for performance expectations for those students. What do you expect them to learn? And there ought to be a way of both measuring how the schools spend the money and whether the students are meeting the performance expectations that you're creating.
So central to it then would be the meeting of the expectations. And based on the diversity of applications in the state of Oregon, the different situations, the school districts that are in my legislative district and Representative Butler's district are very different from the ones that are in Representative Nolan's district. And the decisions about how to spend the money necessarily need to be made differently. Right. But holding people or holding the districts accountable to the students' progress would seem to be a more straightforward way than becoming involved in some really convoluted argument about how each district should spend their money.
Madam Chair, I totally agree with you. And that would be the role. When you think about a procurement role for the legislature, that would be exactly the role. Your job would be, if defined as you say, it would be how much should we be spending per student, not how this district should be spending the money. You'd want to know how they spent their money. You'd want to have, through the database, you'd want to have information. But the key question is, what are your expectations when you distribute that money for student outcomes for those students, the state-level outcomes that you want to make sure are achieved? That is what I would define as a procurement budgeting process.
Well, and I would think that we are, in our somewhat convoluted and cumbersome way, moving in that direction now.
I totally agree. and I think the challenge and the opportunity now is to take what the work you've done and to take it to a more formal level of to define your role as that, so everyone understands the role you're playing, and then to create what I would call a performance-based budget system, where you have, again, defined students, define dollars per student, define performance expectations, and then leave great flexibility at the district level on how to spend the money, but hold the districts accountable to specific performance expectations.
Well, and I would submit that in the K-12 system, the No Child Left Behind Act has pretty much defined the outcomes for us, and with some pretty stiff penalties mm-hmm. if we don't achieve the outcomes. And that the immediate challenge that we're facing, we got the DBI, but because we have this really cobbled together data collection mm-hmm. system, the data takes a long time to get to the point where it's useful. And one of the proposals that the e-board will consider this week is to fund a system that's comprehensive across the state and will allow that data to be collected, being much more clean up front mm-hmm. and being able to be used in a much more timely way.
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, completely agree with you. I mean, that's absolutely an essential piece to do. And if you assume the role we're defining, one of the key pieces of work is a transparent and very clear and data system where you can rapidly get information about system performance, how you should know how each school is spending its money, how it's performing, and again have a way of reviewing. But again, think about your role, what you would be doing if that were for the role, and again extend that on into community college and higher ed. The role of the legislature is to set performance expectations for the dollars you allocate, and then reviewing whether the schools are actually meeting those, and then figuring out, obviously, for those parts of the system that weren't performing, figuring out what kind of intervention strategies you would adopt. I would submit that would be a role, a very powerful role for you to play, one that you could make good policy trade-offs, policy choices, and stimulate the kind of improvement to education by giving the flexibility at the local level to experiment that would really drive system change and higher performance. Again, if that's the role you play, then a lot of things follow in terms of budget process, right? You know, the role of how you distribute the money, a whole lot of change would be required, but I think it would be a set of changes that would really add value to the legislature's role and the state role, and really help schools perform at higher levels on behalf of students.
Yeah. If I could, Duncan, it sounds good, and a lot of things mm-hmm. sound good mm-hmm. and easy until you're on the ground.
Yeah.
You started with Measure 5 mm-hmm. and the Education Act of the 21st Century, which was an attempt at mm-hmm. performance-based mm-hmm. and which has, you know, proved to be harder to do than any of us imagined.
Right.
So how do we approach it differently that we don't get ourselves locked into disagreements over what we're measuring mm-hmm. and how we're measuring them? Because
well,
I think that's
a great question.
Central to the whole discussion.
Madam Chair, this brings us to the agenda that we see ahead of us. There are three big pieces if you want to move in the direction I'm describing. One is you do need good performance data. And, again, I know there's all sorts of – there are great concerns with the current state assessment, how they hook into the community college assessments and higher ed assessments. We can create a great performance data system in Oregon. We'll have to review our current practices. We'll have to look at new, we have to keep an open mind. But, you know, this is something that's, as Representative Morgan mentioned, with the No Child Left Behind, it's a national movement to have good performance data. We need to be the best at this, and we need to figure out how to create very good performance data. The key to me is that the state doesn't need to review every piece of curriculum. Obviously, there needs to be local control on a lot of this work, but what the state does need to do is define what the fundamental outcomes for student learning are that the state as a whole cares about. And I would submit math, of course, reading and writing, some core science skills are absolutely essential, and we need to make sure the students are learning those things. We need a performance measurement system to do it. The joint boards is currently working on that topic. We've gotten a lot of support to do that work, and we need to bring to you next session a redesigned performance management system that does the performance measurement for the state. The second piece of work, and this is a lot of work, is the data system that Representative Morgan mentioned. We do need a more nimble, a better way of getting bringing data to you and to measure school performance and to help students to track individual student performance. And the third piece is a new budget system, and that's the biggest of them all. I would argue that to do the kind of work the legislature can do, you'll need to redefine the way you organize the budget and actually how you run the budget process. And I completely agree that that is a huge assignment. And if you choose to do it, you're going to need help. We'll try to find help to support this. This is a major conceptual redesign. But I would argue that without that, you are not going to achieve the kind of education goals you want. You're not going to be able to see in a transparent way how money is flowing and to make the kind of choices I think you need to make to really help the system improve.
Duncan, how does the OBA vision the funding system looking?
Okay, so OBC, Madam Chair, OBC, but that's our. Excuse me. I know we got the acronym problems, so just for the record, the Oregon Business Council. The funding system. I mean, there's two pieces. One, the revenue side, or the budget side. The budget picture I would describe, and we have it in the paper. I think the most fundamental way would be on page 8 of the paper I passed out. The idea, the design we're proposing, and again, this needs to be pounded and tested. This is a concept. It would take a lot of work to implement. Would be a design that starts with students, and would organize the budget around categories of student service. As you see here, we'd start with early childhood, and the questions you'd ask are: how many students are we trying to serve? How much per student are we going to provide? And what are the performance expectations? That's on a separate chart, but what are the performance expectations? And that would be the way you would start the conversation. And so as you can work through this, you can see you'd organize the next level would be elementary education. We've got 241,000 students. How much are we going to spend per regular student? And then, again, what are the performance expectations that we would want to have? In addition to the regular students, you'd have additional dollars for special needs students, for English as second language, the special education. You would unbundle the services, not around K-12 and higher ed, but around student services. So, again, first 2 years of college would be a allocation. It could go to a community college. It could go to the higher ed system, but it would be a dollar per student for access to undergraduate education in the first 2 years, for example. So it'd be a very different way of a conversation. To help inform the dollar per student amount, you'd obviously want to know, well, what is a reasonable level, and that's where the database initiative would come in. You'd want to know, let's just suppose it's, say, $5,500 per student. What you'd want to know is, what is $5,500 by in terms of an elementary school program, if you take an example of elementary education. So if you had an elementary school with 200 students at $5,500 per student, what would you expect at the current salaries and practices of the class size to be? Well, and so you again be able to define that in terms of what the dollars buy, and then understanding what they buy, you would set performance expectations, and then go
and
from there.
And I'm still struggling with what the purpose of this is. The purpose is so you can break it down into discrete units and find out if each unit is doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Three purposes really. One is that so you understand that gives you the information. Second, to then set performance expectations. Third, to identify parts of the system that may be growing more rapidly or raising red flags. For example, just to use one, special education has been growing at a very rapid rate. We spend more on special ed than, for example, higher education at this point. Not to say those aren't wise dollars spent, but if you unbundle it, you can take a look at those and ask, are there different ways of doing services? So you can examine individual pieces and ask, are we using the money as wisely, and are there different ways of providing it? And then finally, and perhaps I would argue most importantly, you can set priorities. By understanding the flow and understanding the performance, you can ask yourselves, are we looking at the whole continuum, putting the dollars in the best place, and maybe make decisions on where you would want to reprioritize. By having it all laid out in front of you, it's not just three big chunks of dollars. It's really ability to then think through where you best allocate.
Well, it would essentially be one big chunk of dollars. Because
but
right now, within those three big chunks of dollars, there's a whole bunch of subcategories
right.
that are...
Right. And what we would try to do with this is to unbundle it so that you could then compare across the whole education enterprise. So you'd say, you know, where, you know, how much are we spending? How does a higher ed allocation compare with a K-12 allocation? So you could look at it at once and decide where you wanted to put your priority, where you want to put your priority in terms of student support and access. And that would be I think a big advantage of just understanding at once how the total education funding is how you're spending your dollars, and then get where your priorities ought to be.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weiss, in your database that you're envisioning, your transparent system, are you talking exclusively about data that already exists, and the issue is just that it isn't readily available to legislators? It's available to classroom teachers and to principals and to local school board members, but not to us? Or are you envisioning a substantial expansion of the data that would be collected and tracked?
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, most of the data in the K-12 system is available right now. It's really just presenting it in a different way. In the case of community college and higher ed, I think there's a question of whether we have the school-based data that you'd want for decision making. There is not in the community college system, for example, we don't have currently the consistent data, the equivalent of the database initiative for those systems. We could create it, but I don't think we have it in the way that you might want to see it. But really, it's not so much about the collection of data, it's how you use data. And how you organize the budget process with the data that you have, and this would be a different way of looking at the budget process. Now,
may I follow up a little bit on that? Because I want to understand the database. I think knowing an issue and knowing the impact of actions is helpful in guiding the decisions you make. But I've also been involved in some fairly substantial database constructions when I worked for a private utility. They're non-trivial
Absolutely.
To undertake. Have you, and I'm sorry that Representative Morgan isn't here because she said that there's going to be a discussion at the e-board about this. I have not reviewed that particular proposal. Has your group estimated what's involved in the design and the construction of a statewide database to collect the data, make sure it's secure so you don't have issues of private information getting out, what it would cost to do that, how much time it would take to do that, and how we maintain it, what does it take to retrain people? You know, teachers are now collecting this data, but you're proposing to reformat it.
Right.
What does it take to retrain teachers and give them the tools to do it? Where do we get the money?
Right.
Do we find new money to do it, or do we take it out of some existing appropriation?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, we're beginning the work. Some of this is already, as I mentioned, has already been done on the K-12 system. We have, again, on financial data, it's now the data is reported by school and district. The real challenge is getting it. Is speeding up the collection so that it's more usable. In the current proposal that's before the e-board, I'm generally familiar, but I don't want to pretend I'm an expert on it, but it's to accelerate the work for the student plan and profile, which would create an electronic delivery of student data, so the student's data could be tracked as they go from one school to another and move across the system into community college and higher ed. There is a cost to it. At the same time, there are potentially huge savings because it's an electronic system instead of a hand system, and it would also speed up. When we talk with teachers and counselors, they love the idea because they get information immediately. A student comes in, they know exactly who the student is, what their background is, what their scores are, and it gives a lot of information that actually improves the ability to serve students. there is an investment
cost. Get over that.
Yeah, there is an investment cost. There is an investment cost, but the savings are likely to be large. And again, that's the investment. The legislature did appropriate, I think it was $5 million in this last, it's going before e-board. That's a good investment in terms of potential savings and in terms of improvement. But the work now that proceeds, and the department has got work to look at the next stage, we need to continue to look at the data system and look at different ways to manage data to meet higher performance data, higher performance in data collection and delivery. I believe, in talking to the superintendents and others, that when this is all said and done, we're going to save a lot of money because we have a lot of the data silos are all over the landscape. And when you actually think about one unified system, there will be actually savings. But to your point, I think there will be investment required, not only now but probably in the next biennium to really make this happen. But and so I would say there, and I don't know the amount. That's the work we need to do this interim. My argument would be with that data system, you will improve decision making, and I think even more importantly, on the ground, having good data on students and able to move it through the system quickly will have huge benefits and savings to the system.
But is this something that you think we can implement during the interim for $5 million?
We'll get a start. You take a look at what we've got. What it buys, and again, I'm not the expert on this, but it buys an important part of developing a student plan and profile, which is an important piece of this data. And again, I think Mr. Sager is here, probably can speak to it a little more. But it's an important piece to connect the K-12 community college and higher ed systems together so that they can talk to each other through the electronic plan profile.
Madam Chair and colleagues, I don't fashion myself an expert, although I do know a few things in this arena, both in my professional life and having served on the Information Management Technology Committee. I think we would do a disservice to ourselves and our constituents if we think we can do something as significant as this in a short period of time and for very little money. I think it would blow up in our face. And if we're going to pursue this, which I think it's worth a lot of discussion about the benefits, we ought to make sure that we're doing it right and that we are investing the time and expertise and time to get it right.
Excuse me, I think we're a little off. I think we're a little off subject when a point well taken and we'll discuss it. It's before the e-board.
Yeah, it's before the e-board. And again, I'm not pretending to be an expert. I know that I'm very confident the staff working on this is really first rate. I'm confident we're moving ahead. Well, but again, those are good questions. Now, this is a long way of getting to the stability issue. I appreciate that, but it's all context to the task at hand. On the stability question, number one, the Business Council, for a long, long time, for 8-10 years now, has argued that we need a strong stability fund in Oregon, that the current revenue system with its dependence on income tax is simply too unstable to provide the quality of services throughout this economic cycles. And as Representative Morgan and Haas both mentioned, I think it's not just K-12, it's the whole system that is unstable. And you, of course, live this more than anyone in the state. You know this better than anyone. So one critical issue at hand is how big a stability fund should we have? We listen hard to your staff. Paul, I think, serves us all very well. He's fantastic. And the analysis we've done with his help, and I think you've seen as well, is that the current amount of about 5% or $500 million is not really enough to deal with the kind of cycles that we could go through. And our recommendation has been to add another $500 million and create a stability fund of roughly $1 billion. And I think that should be a policy goal that the legislature, you all understand better than anyone why that's an important goal, and I would encourage you this interim to embrace that. Whatever you do, however you organize it, let's raise the current limit and get it into a practice so that we've got the resources when we come to the next downturn so that we can provide stable funding for a lot of services that are really, really important.
Madam Chair, if I may, thank you. Duncan, you were here for some of the prior discussion. The concern that we have is that if we have a $1 billion, and I think you're right, absolutely on target, if we have a $1 billion education stabilization fund, well, first of all, we've got to build it and have the foresight to build it and the restraint to be able to build it. But secondly, once that education stabilization fund is built, and Dr. Warner brought it out, once you start to dip back in to whatever you put the name on the stabilization fund, then you've got the state police,
right.
You've got the other safety, public safety issues, you've got the human service issues. Those folks don't have a stabilization fund. And so what we do is we come back into the stabilization fund for education and say, this is dedicated to education, but somebody else has a great need over here, so we'll reduce the general fund support for education, and we will use that to take care of these other. So it's the balloon effect.
I understand.
You squeeze the balloon in one spot and it bulges out in another. So any foresight opinion that you could help us from OVC in that regard?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I mean, I totally agree with you, and I think when we've talked about stability funds, we've thought about it for the general fund. I mean, if you dedicate it to education, I understand that, but it's in many ways very fungible in terms of how you can manage this. And so, our thinking has always been not just on education, but for the general fund, given the size of it, about a 10% or about $1 billion.
So, follow up, Sir Duncan, you're saying that the $1 billion, which is roughly 10% of the total personal income tax portion, That's what you're looking
somewhere at. Somewhere in that range, and that's what we've been advocating for. And again, I would all said though, I want to you deserve to be praised. The fund you've created is really great. And again, with the as Paul mentions, with the growth in the lottery, it's a significant fund that you have created. And again, I think the limit of 5% was, I mean, a limit you decided on, and I think upon reflection, I would encourage you to raise it. And then obviously if you can find ways to add into it faster, that would be a very positive thing to do. And I think if you're here at the next recession, or your successors will all be very grateful if we create that. The second piece to it really speaks again to what Representative Haas and Morgan were talking about. On the broad state budget policy, the question is, what are the forecasts of demand for services in all the categories over the next 10 to 15 years? And again, one of the things we've encouraged, and I think you, it's the committee, I think you really can't avoid this question as you do your work on the education piece, is to try to come to grips with a long-term forecast of service requirements and what it's going to cost over time in relation to the forecast of revenue. Paul started this last interim, as you may recall. We had a committee started to do a long-term budget process, and the special sessions quickly eliminated that work. And again, I think it's work that still needs to be done. We've modeled that a bit, just on sort of, I would call it more back of the envelope. But if you just take the demographics of different populations, prisons, as you were describing earlier, and then forecast them with some dollar per client, if you will, you'll begin to see what your long-term outlook is. And again, with the demographic shifts that you were talking about, education, K-12 is a relatively flat category for the next 10 years compared to other categories. And getting your mind around those will help you think about the budget challenges you face long-term. And I think that's an important piece of work to be done before a legislative session, to understand what your long-term challenges are and what parts of the system may need special look, given the growth trends that you're dealing with. For example, obviously, the obvious example is with the escalating cost of health care, that's going to gobble up the entire budget if we don't somehow come to grips with it and raises some significant flags looking at your long-term budget. Then with the education piece, then that leaves the question, if you want to create some kind of stability mechanism specifically for K-12, you really have two options, which, again, you've already alluded to. One is to take some dollar amount, and the other is to think about a dollar per student. If you want to create some predictability, I'd encourage you to think about those options. I think Representative Nolan raised it. I mean, you can say it's a percentage of personal income, a percentage of the general fund, or another way to think about it is, if you want to do this, is to say there's going to be a dollar amount per client served. Again, that would be more consistent with the budget process I was just suggesting, so that you can so that the districts would have the predictability to know we're going to get a dollar per student, but not necessarily. But again, it's in relation to the clients served. In higher education, that becomes pretty important because that those are populations that are likely to be growing, and so again, the choice of setting a fixed amount with a growing population versus a fixed amount for a flat population is going to affect your allocations over time. So I think if you buy the idea of a budget process for education that's tied around students and numbers of students served, then I would argue you would want to think about that if you want to provide predictability. It would be predictability in dollars per student rather than simply the dollar amount. And again, that's something to think about as you look at this. Again, the stability in closing, and again, I've wandered onto a lot of topics, but the reason I did this is because I think just looking at stability in isolation from adequacy and the design of the system to provide incentives for perpetual and performance improvement, really thinking about the whole role of the legislature, I think unless you have that whole picture in mind and the picture of the whole state budget, I think this could be too narrow a conversation, and you may fix one problem but not really address other problems, and I think this is the time to really look at the whole way we govern the education system in Oregon and think deeply about it, and then with an aim of stability, adequacy, and performance improvement. If we take that as the task, then I think we're going to get a result that Oregonians will be really proud of.
Just a comment. I think that with reference to the discussion around the Education Stability Fund, that Representative Butler, I think, has made some interesting points there, that the Education Stability Fund in reality doesn't end up being an Education Stability Fund. It ends up being a stability fund for all of the areas that the state funds. But I think that one of the things we might be doing by calling it the Education Stability Fund is building an expectation in the education community that they are somehow going to be insulated from whatever happens in the general flow of things, and that we would be well served, I think, as a body to consider some other fund, some other stabilization fund that's dedicated to the other policy areas besides education. And I think also that the point that you raised, Duncan, that just saying that it should be $1 billion is, it may work for this moment in time, but it may not work for two bienniums out in time, and that we should be trying to find some percentage of the total revenue or some way to index it as costs and revenues and service delivery goes up in time. That just kind of putting a dart in the dartboard and saying there's the goalpost may give people a false sense that the situation is really dealt with.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It should be percentage of the general fund. I think it's a more appropriate way to do it. And again, I was using $1 billion as the current, roughly the current marker, but it should be larger. And I think your idea of indexing, it makes a lot of sense to the total size of the revenue.
I have a question and then a comment. And I understand, Madam Chair, that I'm serving on the Task Force on School Stability, but our speaker has raised two other aspects of the governance of schools. And it seems to me that we skirt around the issue of adequacy way too often. So I understand we also have another speaker about to come up, but do we have a take on how well we're doing on adequacy? I did attend your conference last week, and I heard several of the speakers talk about 25 students enter the ninth grade. Six of them end up getting a diploma. Yeah. The drop-off is dramatic. That would tell me that we need substantial effort in addressing the issues of adequacy as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, I would... Adequacy, there's a funding adequacy and there's a performance issue. The first is the question of performance, where I think unequivocally we are not performing where we need to be in the education services for the reasons you just described. We are not matching the needs of a 21st century economy. Then the debate emerges, what do we need to do about it? And it's, I think, a combination of things, most likely of redesigning systems, making them perform better, and probably in more money at the same time as we raise revenue and invest. I think it's likely to be a combination of the two. The point I would make on that is not to say it's a particular number. I've been on the Quality Aid Commission. I'm very familiar with all the numbers, and that's not really my point here. The point I would make is that that needs to be a regular, permanent conversation, and that when you decide how much money you're spending, you should have an opinion about what is it buying and what your performance expectations are. Whatever the amount is, it doesn't really matter to me, the amount. It's simply being clear about what that amount is likely to provide for schools and, again, what your performance expectations are given that amount of money. If we had that built in on a regular basis at the state level, we'd have a much more productive system. And then you can, again, you'll continue to debate. That doesn't solve your problem, but it's a budget system that would be robust and allow you to move forward, I think, in a really powerful way over time.
Well, could I ask your model for all this? Where does it come from? Where can we see it in action? Reinventing the wheel is cautiously done.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. It doesn't exist. I want to be clear on that, and we've tested this nationally. There's a lot of support. People say this is absolutely the right direction, the combination of a transparent, the curriculum alignment that the governor's asked the joint boards to do, a new budget system, and the data systems. We've been around the country testing it, and people, the reaction we get is this is absolutely where America needs to go, and we aren't there yet. Most states do not have the luxury that Oregon has, that every part of the system right now, for better or worse, is in your hands, in the sense that you determine the funding levels, and it creates an opportunity in Oregon that many states don't enjoy because their parts of the system are locally funded. So you have, I think, a special opportunity to do this if you choose to, but I can't agree with you more. This is an enormous undertaking. And if you choose to do it, we're going to have to all work our tails off, and we'll do everything we can to support you in doing it. And frankly, there are a lot of questions that you will have that I have that I don't know answers to. And so it would be a major task. But where I've come to, and I think a lot of my members, and I hope you'll ultimately agree, is that we have to do this. It's not a choice, that the current design of the system is simply not adequate. And if we believe that education is a critical priority, we've got a series of systems that were designed for a different time, different purposes, and it's time to reflect on them and realize as you reflect on them that they just simply aren't designed for the goals we have in mind for ourselves. And so we have to do it. And it'll be hard, and it'll take bipartisan cooperation, and it'll take cooperation across branches and all of that, but in the end, students will be a lot better off, and Oregon will be a lot better off if we do this work.
Madam Chair, Duncan, is this on the web, your 19-page document here?
Yeah, it's on the web. There are actually six white papers that we prepared under the umbrella of the Higher Ed Roundtable that go through. This is just one of six, and we're going to do, I think, two more before we're done. The first is a summary. Then we talk about the economic need. We talk about current performance of the system, and two papers on that. And then
what is that website?
It's if you go to Oregon Ed Roundtable, you can get it there, or you can get it on the OregonBusinessPlan.org, or you can go to Oregon Bar Business Council. Any of those will get you into it. But probably the easiest is Oregon Ed Roundtable. It's really fun.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
for
so much.
Coming, and we appreciate your thoughts and the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Incredible. Mr. Sager from the governor's office, present. Have charge will travel.
Well used.
And could you also sort of dovetail a little with our previous speaker and how this...
Absolutely.
Thank you. Can we get more content?
Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, James Sager from the governor's office, and I'm glad Duncan went ahead of me because you can hear the complexity of this conversation, and I have the pleasure of talking to Duncan on a very regular basis as he serves on the K-14 Board of Education and the joint boards, and so we've been working on a lot of these pieces together. And so let me start by reiterating something that Duncan said several times, and that is when we talk about the education enterprise, what the governor is talking about is not just a funding mechanism or funding commitment, which I'll get into in a little more detail in a minute, but it is all the realignment work that he has directed the boards of education to take charge of and to carry out, because there are system alignments which provide for greater efficiencies and effectiveness in the system, which impact the amount of dollars that we need to put in the system, et cetera. So we have all that work going on, and we can get into some more detail there on that work. And you also have to try and keep in mind that it is very easy for all of us to kind of fall into the traditional thinking of a student. They start in preschool, and they move through high school into post-secondary, and then on into adult life. We're not talking about just that segment of students. We're talking about the adult workforce also, because as employees need to be retrained, as we become more, you know, global economy and internationally competitive, we have to be able to retrain through our community college systems, our university systems, our current workforce, and be able to expand. And those things have to run in sync with each other. If you look at the average community college and several of our university programs, you no longer see the 19, 20-year-old. You see the 29, 30-year-old, the 47, 50-year-old. I mean, this is a lifetime education system, and so that's why it's important that we think of it as this enterprise and how these pieces connect with each other. If we provided absolutely the best K-12, best-funded K-12 system in the country, and we have a second-rate post-secondary system, we lose those students. They will go away, they will get their advanced training, and they don't come back because the system wouldn't be here in place to support those kinds of jobs. If we have the number one post-secondary system and a lousy K-12 pipeline, then we have ignored our own children, and we're not preparing them to take advantage of the post-secondary system. So they really have to work in tandem as a single system. And all of the funding commitment and being able to set performance measurements, et cetera, have to be aligned so that, in fact, we get away from this impression that many people have that, for instance, we have No Child Left Behind requirements, that with today's funding, that just miraculously, suddenly we can meet a standard of performance that has never before been met in this state or this country. And so we have to bring those conversations in alignment. That's why the data system is so important, and we can answer some questions there. That's why this alignment is important. And for Oregonians to understand how we're spending the money so that they get past this idea that we're just dumping money into the black hole of education or the black hole of Salem, but really understand what's going on. The component pieces of the governor's funding commitment of the education, Paul did a very good job of laying it out. The enterprise is pre-K through adult learning. It includes the three schools of education at OHSU, so we have nursing, dental, and medical school up there. It also includes the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, where we have the opportunity grants, et cetera. So again, we're looking at the entire continuum, a 10% floor commitment to those pieces in each biennium to move forward so that they do have some stability and predictability so that they can make some long-term planning. The problem that we have in the sectors right now is, number one, they don't know from biennium to biennium, sometimes year to year, how much money they're going to be able to have. So do you hold on to it, you build a big reserve because you're afraid next year we're going to lose money? You know, you can't make long-term strategic investment decisions, et cetera, inside a sector, let alone be able to talk across sectors and say, you know, if we invest some of our money in this piece, how will that impact your sector and vice versa? A good example is remediation at the community college level. Now, we can talk about if we better prepare 12th graders, make sure that they're ready for post-secondary, that can reduce remediation at the community college, thus free up dollars at community college that they could use on other programs. Now, we have to be able to break that down to say, well, is the average student that's actually taking remedial classes at community college the 19-year-old, or is it the 29-year-old who hasn't had math for 10 years? And, you know I would need a remedial class right now if I wanted to go back and take college algebra again. I just don't remember that stuff. So, those are the kinds of, the kind of clarity that you need when you start looking across sectors and look at the students that, and you're focused on students as opposed to institutions. The other example is currently we're asking our high schools to provide more college level classes for juniors and seniors. One interesting thing we discovered was that we have 17 community colleges and 7 public universities, and you ask, what is the standard for writing 121? Probably get 23 different answers, even though I'll say two of them that would agree. And so what we've asked is the faculty of the systems to get together and identify what those standards are at the post-secondary level. So that way we can turn back to K-12 and say, if you have a high school student that meets the standard, that now meets the college requirement, we can give credit, et cetera. And so now we're dealing with those seamless issues. All of those impact how the dollars flow and how they can be best used and utilized. So you begin to look at effectiveness issues and efficiency issues that may help us do better with what we have. That's what we're hoping. But at the same time, we need the dollars to invest in very strategic areas. The governor's plan puts the money into, we call it the successful schools for lack of a better title right at the moment. But he views that instead of that money being dedicated to a particular sector, he wants those dollars to go to the Joint Boards of Education where they can, again, look at the system and say, where is the best place to invest the next dollar? What are we going to get for that kind of investment? For instance, this alignment issue. It costs a lot of money to pull faculty members out of their classes and their responsibilities, whether it's at the K-12 level or the post-secondary level, to look at alignment issues. And yet that investment could mean that next year, when the alignment is complete, we're able to do things a lot more efficiently and a lot more effectively for students. And so while we've made that investment, it isn't an ongoing expense necessarily, but it has definitely helped the system. So we need to be able to look at those kinds of strategic decisions as opposed to saying, well, it can only be inside a particular sector of the system. The other difference that we had was, and I'm saying difference, and this is a difference between the way the governor viewed it and the way the speaker's plan viewed it. Instead of when we reached the cap for the stability fund, instead of those dollars flowing into the capital construction piece, we put them back into the successful schools fund. And the reason is because the governor wants to make sure that those dollars stay in the operations side of the equation. I mean, in fact, we know that local communities can go out and bond for capital construction. That really isn't the problem that we're hearing today as much as we can build a building, but we can't, buy the teachers and put the programs in there and provide the operation to make sure that the program works. So we want to try and differentiate between those dollars that are going in for operational expenses and those dollars that are for long-term bondable capital construction items. Coming in after different speakers, I'm just trying to fill in holes rather than bore you with starting with steps 1 and 2. But so I guess it might be better to open it up to questions from you, so that way I can address thoughts that you might have that would be helpful.
Questions from the committee? I'll start this off with a simple one. It appears that under this, you would give there would be some mechanism that and I presume it would be through this board's process, where you pool this money, and then, like, the K-12 formula would be somehow, the allocation would be changed, and I'm not sure what the mechanism is, Jim, or what's envisioned here.
Sure. Chipper, the 10% floor and any additional appropriation that would be part of the basic allocation would go through the funding formulas as it currently exists. The dollars going into the investment fund or the successful schools fund under the governor's plan would be pooled, and the joint boards of education would take input from the different sectors and then, working with them, decide where is the best place to make that investment. Part of it would, I'm sure, depend on, well, how much do we have this time? What can we do? Part of it would be looking at, again, do we have such a narrowing of the pipeline at a particular point in the system where, you know, we can't get any better outcomes? We can't, you know, have more engineers, for instance, coming until we deal with this crimp in the pipeline, and so that's where we need to invest a different dollars. Additional dollars. So that way you have a system look at this rather than, again, just isolated as in sectors. Now, you know, again, I'm sure there can be very good arguments put forward to say, well, if it was allocated within the sectors, that you could make strategic investments in each sector. I mean, those are the kinds of issues that the governor is very open to conversations about, but he really is trying to drive the work of the joint boards and the work of all of us to look at this as a system rather than pieces, and not having those connection points really makes sense.
Again, I'm kind of trying to grapple with the thinking behind mooshing all of the aspects of education into one big ball. And what I think about is the mess that we've got with DHS right now, where we've mooshed all kinds of human services into one big ball and nobody can figure it out, and nobody can, there's no discrete parts that you can get your hands around anymore. So I have that concern that I don't want to create something that is going to approximate the issues that we have with K-12. I also have trepidations from the perspective that we are, I think, working fairly successfully right now in dealing with the more, better, faster issues, which I hear Duncan talking a lot about and I hear the governor talking a lot about. And it's built around the sectors of education coming together and bringing a vision and a plan before the legislature, and convincing us that it's worth investing the state's dollars or the taxpayers' dollars in. Why is there this big push to create this kind of monolithic entity that where all this happens inside of it, rather than continuing with the structure as it is right now, but administratively and from a funding of projects perspective, force the pieces to come together and work together?
Chipper, Representative Morgan, I appreciate that question. And what the governor does not want to have happen is some new, like you say, monolithic entity where now things become actually more cumbersome rather than less. We have, as I've indicated to folks before, I think we're at that moment where the stars have aligned, and we have folks in each of the sectors of education, leadership and as well as faculty and support staff, that really see this vision of this coordination, and so they have been stepping up and doing yeoman's work around trying to do as much as they can with the resources we have.
I agree with you.
So there's a lot of synergy.
Things going on.
Yeah, there are a lot of great things, and you know, I'd love to spend hours with you talking about all the work that is going on, because it's really exciting. But it's to try and put into place greater stability for that kind of energy to continue into the future. Greater stability in, again, the sectors to understand their funding future, so that they can make long-term plans rather than always worrying about, you know, where the next cut is going to take place, so that they can have those conversations across the sectors, so that they can actually leverage their dollars with each other rather than concern that if I spend it over to help you, I'm, you know, my immediate responsibility, my students aren't going to benefit, and those kinds of conversations. So the governor's desire is to shift us from having gone from three very clear silos, or in this case maybe seven different silos, to where we currently have this wonderful volunteer effort going on, to moving it into more of a systemic process, to where that continues into the future, where the focus really is on students, and we have the kinds of policy discussions, as Duncan talked about, where we say, here's what we want here as a state, as a community, here's how we're going to invest in the system, and really, really change that, that conversation. If you look at recent history, if you look at the past 15 years, even during boom times, education would argue that they didn't reap the benefit of the boom times in Oregon. If you look at the conflict that has happened inside the education sector at the end of legislative sessions, often it's not, wow, the whole system came out better. It's, you know, K-12 got it and, you know, OUS didn't, or vice versa. You know, it's winners and losers. The governor wants to get us past that kind of situation where, again, we're looking at the system and we're trying to advance the system for the benefit of the state of Oregon, not just a particular sector. That might be a long answer to a short question. I'm sorry.
And I can see the vision. I'm just not convinced that it is functionally going to be any different than it is now, in terms of there's still going to be feelings that the one sector gets favored over another sector, one sector's initiative didn't get funded and another one's did. You're just going to change the stage that the discussion's going to be held in.
Well, Chair, Representative Morgan, I agree with you in part, and that is those funding levels above the 10% floor. So you would have proposals coming forward to the legislature from the sector saying, you know, we need to invest in engineers at the university system. And here's a dollar amount, and gee, the K-12 proposal didn't make it. You're going to have those kinds of discussions. But as far as the ongoing maintenance of programs, and in fact, we believe with the 10% commitment, it actually gives each sector a little bit of growth over time so that they can actually be looking even inside their own systems for ways to get more and better performance from the students in the system. So now the discussion isn't kind of survivability. The discussion is, gee, you got your package and we didn't. Okay, that's going to exist in any process. But that floor budget level, that ongoing program level, has to have that stability so that the system, in fact, can continue to make better strategic decisions together.
Did that answer your question?
No, but...
Okay.
Yeah, it's a...
I just don't think that we ever end the debate. I mean, you brought up earlier the debate with DHS, and you know, I mean, we're always going to have to make those kinds of decisions. You're going to, you know, I just don't get the chance to present the governor's opinion, but
I dropped my contact.
So we're always going to have those kinds of issues. This isn't trying to eliminate that kind of conversation debate. It is trying to put that stability under the system so that they can make better strategic long-term decisions that help the system and collaborate much more closely and on a regular basis throughout the system so that we don't ever fall back into that kind of sector mentality.
If I could sum up how I think I'm understanding this. We started out with a concrete proposal that allocates funding directly to the K-12 system on a systemized basis based on revenue. We moved to a discussion of a different way of allocating, more programmatic and less based on historic systems, for the whole piece, not just K-12, but everything. And now we've gone back to sort of a middle thing that looks at the whole thing as a not just K-12, but K-12, the whole educational continuum, does part of the floor piece, and then allocates a piece above that into some system that goes where the problems are. Am I close?
Madam Chair, I think you summarized it well. You're right. It provides that stability with the floor. It also provides quicker growth in the stability fund for education, and it provides an investment component where strategic investments can be made.
That is broader than just K-12.
That is broader than K-12.
Is that fair? Am I close with the committee as to what we've been talking about today?
Madam Chair, I did have one question for Jim while he's here. I just want to make sure that my definitions are correct. When we're talking about schools and the education enterprise here with the governor, we've got basically seven disparate parts or parts that we need to identify. You've got the OPK Head Start. You've got the K-12 and then the community education, Department of Education. Next, your community college and workforce development. The Oregon University System, OHSU, Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Now, I've got a number of questions in that regard, not the least of which would be how we bring OHSU back under the umbrella. Remember, they're a nonprofit corporation that we have, while we have continued to assist them, we've been cutting the strings, which the umbilical cord which previously attached us, Jim. I'm anxious to know if there's a vision how we do that in this process to bring them, and I'm not an advocate for this, so I need to be careful, how you're intending to bring them back under an umbrella when we told them, get away, come back.
Chair Berger, Representative Butler, thank you for the question. That's why the governor has been so clear about focusing on the three schools of education. And let me just give an example. I mean, nursing, OHSU is the entity that we have coordinated our nursing program statewide, looking at the full bachelor's degree as well as the master's degree program for nursing. And so it's important that they remain a vital partner in the education enterprise. There are lots of programs that OHSU carries out that are not part of those three schools of education. So the governor has tried to identify it. It is those pieces that are part of the education enterprise that must remain, a part of the system as we're looking at it. Because we don't have, and we're not necessarily promoting, the governor isn't promoting that, we find another entity to provide the bachelor and master degree programs on the public side in the state of Oregon, but rather recognizing that they provide a vital function in that component, and in those areas we need to remain in close partnership with them so that we can address the workforce shortage in the state when it comes to health care.
Good follow-up, then, Chair. Thank you very much. Jim, that's an excellent segue to my next question in that regard, as we're trying to identify what is the education enterprise in the state of Oregon. And Madam Chair, this is all a precursor to something that I want to come back to after Jim's presentation. But as we talk about the community college and workforce development, then there's another partner in this process, and that is the Department of Employment. They need to be at the table in this process. Does the governor's plan have them folded in here somehow, or are they just another consulting entity that may have some input but has totally separate budget issues?
Chair Berger, Representative Butler, again, you've really moved us over to that alignment issue side as opposed to the funding piece. They are not a part of the funding commitment. The Employment Department is almost totally funded out of federal dollars and other resources, but they are clearly at the table with us coordinating this kind of work. When we look at community colleges, they are kind of the linchpin in this system, providing that workforce training, providing that first step for high school graduates wanting to go on to post-secondary classes, the apprenticeship programs, et cetera. So they are vital, and we need to connect their work, the programs that they offer, with the economic development plans in communities, so that way we have a matchup. We shouldn't be creating 5,000 diesel mechanic certified diesel mechanics in an area that doesn't need any diesel mechanics. but we need diesel mechanics. So we need to look at how we coordinate that kind of service, and that is the work that the Employment Department provides us, just a wealth of information to help us target those decisions.
And Madam Chair, without making it an informative question, that is a concern. While we're talking about stable schools, we're really talking about, in part, stable school funding. And when we talk about stable funding, we need to talk about the stability of our workforce development in that process.
That's right.
And I see that Oregon Department of Employment has a place at the table.
Have we got further questions?
Mr. I was just going to say, if I could, Chair Berger, just to expand a little bit on what Representative Butler, I think, started to touch on, and this has been the message over and over from the governor, and you heard it last week at the summit. He sees this clear connection between our economic future and having a strong education system. And the first question that new potential employers to the state and employers in the state who are looking to expand, the first question he receives is, do I have the workforce system that I can you know, support my business? That is what will draw businesses to Oregon, and that is why it is so important that this system have that stability, so that in fact we can make those kinds of long-term commitments to Oregon businesses and future Oregon businesses to grow this economy. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. If we're not totally brain dead, members of the committee, this has been a long session and a lot of information. I think that what I'm looking for now, by the way, at the next meeting, I have invited school advocates, OEA, OSPA, those folks to come in and talk about the specific proposals that we've heard of today, and hopefully they're in the room or listening and understand the sort of what went on today, and their comments will dovetail with what we've heard today. But I'm also looking for, on top of the specific tasks that you've asked Paul and his staff to give us information on, for some thoughts as to what more you want to hear, who you want to hear from. And you don't have to decide right this minute. Think about it and let us know where you want to carry this. This is your task force, and I want to get us where we want to go, we're starting with this and moving forward into some ideas about funding and budgeting, and we've been all over the map. So I'd really like to hear from you your thoughts on what next steps and who you want to hear from and what things you want to pursue most vigorously.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I could lead off this conclusion of this discussion, I see there are three things that are either stated or part of what it is that we're doing in this committee. This is a stable schools committee, task force on stable schools. But the word that's not in there that's been discussed, and you just said it yourself, was funding. And so defining schools, we have a list of where the governor's coming from. And I think that that's a pretty good start. I am concerned when we talk about schools, we talk about education statewide, we talk about workforce, we talk about workforce development statewide. I think those are all part of that, and certainly Jim mentioned that if you just grab the School of Nursing, that's one of a part of the kinds of workforce development we're talking about. With regard to stable, I've written down some things that folks have said today. I think the one that impressed me the most was one that Representative Morgan elicited from Duncan Wise, and that is the adequacy of the opportunity. That is, I think that is really, really important. The adequacy of the opportunity for a student who has very little opportunity to achieve, or who has difficulty in achieving that's something that's, I think, is very, very important as to what's been discussed here. Certainly the quality of education, the transparency of accountability and performance of educational delivery are things we've talked about, and those are Those are all part of stable, what constitutes stable. With regard to funding, while it isn't part of the task force name, it certainly is where we've thumped around here a lot. We've talked about some general funds. We've talked about local school operating revenue. And when I look at my local school operating revenue under the 0.5%, under Measure 5, I see both K-12 and community colleges. And I think we need to take a real strong look at what that local school revenue or operating revenue included in our property tax includes. And finally, we didn't really talk about it at all. We ran out of time, and we carried Duncan over quite a lot, and that's other revenues, the local components that schools have used. I found it very instructive last week to be able to attend the Oregon Business Plan program in the same week that I attended a income tax update in Portland with the local practitioners up in Portland. They spent about a third of their time on Oregon, on the metropolitan business tax, the income taxes up there, and there's some pretty strong feelings as to how that's been administered and where it's going and those kinds of things. But I think that local income tax component that has been used in Multnomah County, the ITAX up there, is something that really we need to have some discussion about. So in your work plan of the committee, as you continue forward, I would certainly like an opportunity for us to come back and examine that local school revenue, operating revenue, as well as the other local revenues which have been used and set apart and set aside for funding education in this process. And then we've touched on it, but it is a very important part, and that is the Secure Rural Schools funding. There's been folks I for one will step up and say, I sure thought that was supposed to stay, to be dedicated back to those local schools who had lost their federal forest receipts. And there's no discussion of that. I had a good opportunity to interview Senator Wyden on a radio program just recently, and I asked him, what's going to happen there? And he said, we're going to get you the money. You decide what's going to happen there. Let that be a local issue. And I appreciated that response, because if they make that a debate in Washington, D.C. as to whether or not we get that look for our local schools or whether it just is spread out in the school funding formula, guess what? Washington, D.C. is going to say, well, if they're going to fight and argue about it, we don't want to be part of that fight. Let's just not give it to them. And rather than do that, I'd rather have it spread, thin the soup for everybody than I would to have it. But I still think that it's something that needs to be discussed in that process. So thank you for indulging me as I've talked about the three parts of the stable schools and the funding that we've talked about here today.
Thank you. I appreciate your thoughts, and you bring in some issues that have been touched on, but perhaps we have not delved into in any that are part of the funding mix. Further discussion.
Madam Chair, I'm not quite so spontaneous as my good friend from Ontario, and I appreciate your invitation to spend some time thinking about this as I digest all of what we've heard today. I mentioned at the start of the meeting that I think it's important for us to try to find a way for the task force to grapple with a definition or some agreement on what outcome or what results we want to achieve in any proposal we present. And if it would work for you, Madam Chair, I'd ask for the opportunity to sit down with staff and look through a couple of different ways of bringing that to the task force for discussion.
Not a problem.
I'll do that.
Welcome that. Any further comments or discussion, if you want?
I welcome a discussion around what I call the mystery money, which I think Representative Butler is referring to as the unaccounted for revenue sources to the local districts. We were in a meeting a week or so ago to write the report that's required by what was then ballot measure 1 about why we didn't fund adequately to the quality education model, and it was an issue that came up there. And in discussions with the Department of Education and the folks that keep track of the money through the database initiative. It's something that they're also trying to grapple with, and there are sizable chunks of money involved in it. And it isn't even, it doesn't all revolve around local revenue. An example would be the anti-discrimination money that the Portland District received as an increase to their component of the Common School Fund. So there's different places that it comes from. But it is interesting that when you take the total amount that's spent in the K-12 arena and you subtract out all the revenue sources that we know about, there's still a chunk of money left there that you can't account for. So it is an interesting conundrum in the accounting of the process. The other question that I had was, I was wondering if during your deliberations of the different permutations of the plans in the regular session, if there was some kind of a matrix set up that compared them side by side.
Don't have a problem with that. I'm going to throw it at Paul. In essence, in a way, I think this is a stab at some of the details in a spreadsheet, and we saw how complicated it was to go through these in terms of a spreadsheet. I think what you envision is a more of a policy than the numbers. This one has this includes K through 12, and this one doesn't. This one has the stability fund going this way instead of that way. This one, in other words, a higher level than the numbers.
I would think of it as a document to be viewed in conjunction with these spreadsheets. And what may work is to take apart the bills that were put forward and try to compare the things, make some common categories and talk about how they differ. Is it possible to do that? Yeah, and would it be helpful? It would be helpful to me, but I don't want to send poor Paul on a mission here just for me.
Well, I think that at some level we need a record of the things we've talked about and how they fit together. And I'm fine with that. I also want to know, you know, what you want to know next in some important way. And, you know, as I said, I offer time to think about it, but contact me. As I said, the advocates, the school professional organizations and advocates are going to be talking to us next time. If there's some particular thing we're looking at that you want them to talk about specifically, that's fine. I'm open to out to input for where you want to go with this. Okay, this is a task force. Let's kind of start thinking of our task. Paul, do you have anything to add to the good of the order, except how attentive we've all been? And
And Madam Chair, I think I can put together a summary matrix that can give you something to kind of use as a guide. And the only other thing would be for the time for your next meeting. And if we sketch that as May, thinking that we've got the June revenue forecast on June 1st. We were talking about House revenue on the 31st, so that might be a time.
Isn't that Labor Day?
Memorial Day is Monday the 29th.
We should be Labor Day.
Memorial Day is Monday the 29th.
So it would be
the official holiday. So we could meet Tuesday the 30th if you're meeting.
Yeah, why don't we determine, you know, if May is okay with the committee, we'll look at the end of May again. Okay? Moving forward. Anything else? Addicts? Practice? Thank you all, and we'll see you in May, not before. We are adjourned.